this farce. This 20th century Bastille that pretends to be a pocket democracy. Why don't you put us all into solitary confinement until you get what you're after and have done with it?
That's enough! I call this meeting to order!
Look at them. Brainwashed imbeciles. Can you laugh? Can you cry? Can you think? Is this what they did to you? Is this how they tried to break you till they got what they were after? In your heads must still be the remnant of a brain. In your hearts must still be the desire to be a human being again.
This is a most serious breach of etiquette. I'd imagine your desire to stand for election was genuine.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 17th of May, 2024. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream. If you want to get straight to the stream at any point, just tap that in, talkradio.org.uk, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Yes, we've got our own app, folks. As I've said a few weeks ago, Nick has updated it, so best thing to do is just deinstall it and reinstall from new. I mean, you can update it, but it tends to take up more space, and I'm not sure if it works quite so well. Anyway, that's available free from all good app stores. The main ones are, of course, Google Play and Apple Store. But please don't use Google Play. Use this thing called Aurora. You can install that, and you get all the original apps, not the ones that Google has messed about with. That is to say, the National Security Agency. Before you are allowed to download it, I mean, particularly Telegram, there is a particular app version of that which is available on Google Play, which isn't the real Telegram. It's the NSA version. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III wage slavery lies. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to every crisis... Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, twisted accelerationist and Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse, in case you hadn't noticed. And they're doing quite well at it, aren't they? And the politicians have nothing to say. We'll be hearing some politicians that have nothing to say again this week. It's like torture. Sorry, folks. I'm honestly not trying to torture you, but it is interesting to hear what some of them have got to say. Nick Land's behaviourist dark enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks, want us as slaves to their machines. Huxley's diabolical plan rewards only blind obedience. And meanwhile, the pantheist, wife-murdering WEF King Tampon Charlie wages war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, with regime change maniac sidekick and referendum failure Diddy David Cameron. So, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's fourth industrial revolution, the attempt to destroy civilization by destroying farmers, and the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and from the PTSD camp in Bath, it's Darren Edmondson. So, welcome, Darren.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Let's just start with this whole idea of the king, because all the soldiers swear their allegiance not to the public, they swear it to the crown.
The crown, yeah, I was going to say. So
what do you, you know, as someone that's dealing with veterans, can you say maybe first of all about what you're up to down in Bath? It's actually near a village, isn't it?
It's Norton St. Philip.
Norton St. Philip.
Yeah, so we're in Norton St. Philip. Joe and Dion are the owners, and they've been going since, I think it's 2017. Now, we're the only free facility for veterans. I've been going there since 2018. I went there Remembrance Day, and, you know, I had my own struggles. I went to Bath, and when you walk through them gates, it's like a weight lifted off your shoulder. Everyone's like one big family, and I went down a wrong path. You know, I'm going to be transparent here. I hit the drugs. And I was in psychosis.
Sorry, what drugs?
Cocaine.
Right.
Okay, cocaine. And I was in psychosis. And I lost my family. I didn't speak to my family. I lost my child. I lost my wife and everything. And these people, Joe and Dion, PTSD Camp Bath, were the only people that didn't give up on me. They never give up on me. They checked in on me day in, day out. From 2018, now we're in 2024. I've sorted my life out. I turned my life around. They were the only ones that never give up on me. And I'm still there today, running the camp now, because I've been there, I've seen it, and I've done it. And I don't judge anyone that gets in contact with me. We're here to help veterans. If you save your, if you save your country should save you. Now, we've got immigration. If I could touch on that subject, got immigration. You got they're coming in three, 4-star hotels, coming in on these dinghies, and we've got over 20,000 veterans homeless on the street. We've got 160,000 homeless people in the UK. Now, if you save your country, our country should save you. And the MPs and the Prime Minister are not for me. They are not supporting our veterans. It shouldn't be the likes of Joe and Dion spending money out of their own pocket, day in, day out. And it just shouldn't happen. Veterans should be looked after.
Well, no, I think most people would agree with that. And I think for many of us over the years, we've seen, I mean, I deal with Bristol Housing Action. We've dealt over the years with many homeless vets who you think, well, how is it that they've managed to get to the situation where they're now sleeping in a doorway? You know, the country's really not looking after them. So I started off by mentioning the king. I mean, this whole thing of, I mean, the allegiance of a soldier, it's very difficult to, you know, your allegiance is specifically to the king in this case, or the crown.
Yeah.
But what about to the country? I mean, isn't that maybe what you're speaking with your mouth when you make an oath of service, say as a commissioned officer or whatever, or even as a general squaddie? Is one thing, but maybe the actual allegiance of the soldier is more to the country rather than the monarch.
I believe it's to the country. I believe it's to the country, yeah. Absolutely.
Martin, do you want to say something, Martin, about the migrants? Because this is it's a bit upsetting for soldiers to see migrants getting a kind of red carpet treatment to immediate accommodation where they're homeless.
Well, there's two questions there, isn't there? There's one about what you swear allegiance to. Of course, in the US, you do swear allegiance to the Constitution, because they don't have, a king, because they had a war about it 200 years ago. I think it's very sad that because of the failures of the way the world is organised, people are not looked after, whether they're veterans or whoever they are. What we've got is a world that's going to war and getting deeper and deeper into war. And one of the things that happens in wars is you create disturbance. At the end of World War II, there were literally millions of people displaced all over Europe, and it took ages to resolve it all.
How do you think the veterans are feeling now? Where they've saved their country, they've done these tours, and they're coming home. And I was homeless. I was homeless.
Well, it's disgusting. Of course, it's totally wrong.
I was homeless in 2016. I've only now got accommodation thanks to Joe and Dion.
Some people would say the British Army is a volunteer army.
Of course, it is.
I mean, some countries like the Ukraine, it isn't a volunteer army. They're grabbing people off the streets and sending them off to the front line with no training at all. But the point about this is, I don't think we should be dividing people. I can see why people be, if you're homeless, you're upset if somebody else has got a house at the head of you.
Yeah, I've been homeless 6 years. Whoever you are, absolutely.
But the problem is that the housing market in this country has been wrecked. Yes. By decades of putting money in the pockets of people with property. If you're on the housing ladder, you can make a packet just by living in your house.
Yeah, of course you can. And of course, getting richer, and that's right.
And this is happening on a global scale as well. Mm. We're all victims of this stuff.
Yeah, of course we are. Yeah.
Well, I think the thing is, that Martin, that there is a system set up for these illegal immigrants, and that they are immediately housed, but the veterans aren't. I mean, can you just bite that little bullet?
Well, I think that you've got to change completely the attitude towards housing. For example, that in the 1920s, the Tory government decided to encourage home ownership by giving tax relief on buying houses.
But this is nothing really to do with the attitude to housing, is it? It's about a waiting list.
No, because it shouldn't be a waiting list. The point I'm making, Charlie, is there shouldn't be a waiting list.
But there is.
There is a waiting list because of the way it's been organised.
How are you going to change that then?
Well, you've got to change completely. When the housing market collapsed in 2008, the banks should have been nationalised. We should have started building council houses.
I'm not talking about what's gone wrong. I think we all know it's gone wrong. What should we do? What can we do now?
Well, I'll tell you what we could do now. We could go around to the big houses in Clifton, and we could commandeer the extra bedrooms, and we could put veterans and homeless people in there.
I agree.
And that's the sort of thing that happens in wartime. Sort of thing that happens in World War II. Yeah.
But actually, the fact is, the poor are largely getting evicted rather than...
Well, that's right. It's the other end of the spectrum.
The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. Well, if you've saved your country, your country should serve you, and I say this time and time again. Yep. I was homeless for 6 years. I'm well known at the minute because I'm known as Pembrokeshire Patriot. I protested outside Penally Camp. I protested it day in, day out. I was there almost 24 hours a day. We had a team set up there. We got the site closed down. We got on.
Can you just talk about this?
Yeah. So Penally Camp is near a place called Tenby in Pembrokeshire.
Yeah.
And I was homeless, and that place should have been there and put up veterans. Should have been near veterans.
Was it an army camp?
It was an ex-military barracks called Penally Camp. Now, I even sent an email to the MPs, and I said, look, this should be housed for veterans, not immigration. For migrants. The migrants came across. They were going in there. I think there was 250 migrants. Now, Penally, the community is only 700, around 700 people. That's a lot of migrants coming in. They were coming in unvaccinated as well. We don't know who these people are. We don't know where they come from. We don't know their backgrounds, So I wrote to a councillor called Joshua Bynan, and I said to him, I'm concerned about our local people. I'm concerned about their backgrounds and et cetera, et cetera. Don't get me wrong, I'm against the COVID, just to make that clear. But anyway, and he said, oh, no, the people that are coming in are teachers, doctors, and whatever. So when the migrants actually arrived at Penally Camp, I went and spoke to them. We got video footage. They weren't doctors. They weren't teachers. So I emailed Joshua Bynan and said, this is what you have said. He said, sorry, I meant to say I thought they were going to be.
Oh, right. Well, mm-hmm. It's just the politicians having nothing to say again. So do you want to tell us about this raid? Because this is the first time I came across Dion and Joe was when there was a special branch anti-terror squad raid on the PTSD camp. This is last year, was it, or maybe the year before?
It's been 2 years now. So they were in bed sleeping. They've got their family there. They got two daughters and their boyfriends there and children. When the raid happened, Joe had cheered a noise, and next minute they were held on the floor, zip tied.
So they've been treated there like kind of organised crime.
Yes.
Or a criminal gang of some sort. Before you get into the
homegrown terrorism,
the story, what shocked me was the total lack of coverage.
Absolutely.
So, when I interviewed Joe, after I interviewed Joe, I was chatting to some other local journalists. We'll pass it on. And nothing is said, but nothing appears. So even the local newspapers around here, there was nothing. The local TV and radio, there was nothing.
Unbelievable.
So this smells to me like a D-notice, which is where the military tells the press, we don't want you to report on this. So that's the context that this raid happened, isn't it?
Yeah. So they're bound to hide it, aren't they? They're bound to, because they've messed up. We've now got an NFA. I'm hoping Joe and Dion are going to sue them. And we need the right people. If anybody's listening that can help us, we need to sue these people, because Joe and Dion were zip-tied up in their own home. They lost, I believe, nine puppies were killed in the raid. Their children were
How did they kill puppies?
I'm not sure how they did. Well, I do know, because we have people here that look after them and feed them, and they just recently had puppies, so they'd lost animals. Like, they have goats, they have geese, they have donkeys.
Right. They'd taken everybody off the site, but there were animals there, animals that weren't being fed, etc.
They held Dion for two or Dion and Joe for 2 or 3 days and put them up in hotels. But when they were in these hotels, they were following them. They were observing them, following them. Now they didn't. That's so disrespectful. When Dion, it was a paratrooper, free para, and he's our hero. He's my hero, and so is Joe. They don't give up on vets, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you've done. They are there for you day in, day out. And when I first went to camp and I left and I rang them up, I was in psychosis, drug-induced psychosis. This camp, I've done rehab courses, I've done drug rehabilitation courses. I've gone to this camp and I'm clean. I'm sober.
So what have
and
Joe,
I'm not running the camp.
Well, what's Joe and Dion got that the other places didn't have?
They care. They've got love. They check in on you. They don't judge you. They don't judge what you've done. People make mistakes. People have got a past, but people can change. If you look at my story, I have changed. I wasn't a great person. I wasn't a great father. But if you look at me now, I've changed my life around. And I've my passion for veterans, because they've saved me. I'm now running the camp. I've got a big story to tell. Yeah. And I didn't sleep two nights ago because I had a veteran in crisis. I've got a Welsh veteran down in Pembrokeshire in crisis. And I've got a 72-year-old up north in crisis. So I'm constantly on the phone. I'm trying to relieve pressure from Joe and Dion, because Dion, when he works around that camp, he's constantly working on that camp.
So can you just give us an idea of the daily routine at the camp?
Yeah, okay. So I wake up in the morning. I wake up, if we've got veterans here, I cook them breakfast. I have a chat with them. I make sure they're okay. We sit around and talk.
So are they paying for this? Or?
Joe and Dion, no, it's free for veterans. Oh, veterans right. don't have okay. to pay. Accommodation and food are free. Right. So any veteran that's listening out there, if you're struggling with mental health, drug addiction, or anything, you just need a bit of respite. You don't have to have PTSD. Come to the camp, get a bit of respite. We've got a bunkhouse there. The bunkhouse has got your little front room. You've got three beds. There was a guy, I can't remember his name. Anyway, he wasn't allowed to see his children because he didn't have a house. He was a veteran. They allowed this veteran in the bunkhouse, and he was allowed to see his children every single weekend. Now, that wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the camp.
Okay, so you feed them some breakfast?
We feed them some breakfast. We have a chat. We help out on the farm. If I get a phone call, I'll answer the vets.
So it's livestock, is it? Or livestock?
Yeah, livestock, yeah. So we've got duck eggs, chicken eggs, you've got donkeys, you've got goats, you've got horses.
Yeah, these animals need quite a lot of looking after, don't they?
They do, so we all chip in. Yeah. But they don't expect it, we just want to. Yeah. Because I got a friend living with me now, Kyle Hicks. He's been on the drugs as well, and he's turned his life around. In 2 months, he's turned his life around, and he was injected with an antipsychotic drug, and it's draining him down, he can't, he's struggling to get out of bed, they're just trying to shut him down, and now he's come to camp, he's been there 2 months, and he's done drug rehabilitation courses, he's now clean, in 2 months.
Well, that's pretty good, isn't it? A pretty good record. Maybe you should be a bit better funded by social services or the state.
Correct.
Or something. But anyway, look, let's just finish off. Take us through the day. Yeah.
So we help out on the farm. We let the goats out. We let the donkeys out. We'll do a bit of grass cutting. We'll chop up firewood, because they've also got a separate place called it's glamping. It's posh camping. It's glamping. They've got the tree house, they've got the hunter's lodge, and they've got a pod. Now that they rent them out, but that money that they get for that is put into the camp for the veterans. Now that's their business. They shouldn't be putting their business money to help the veterans, but they do, because
there certainly should be charities out there. Yeah. Helping along that. Yeah. You've got to have a full-time fundraiser though, pretty much, to
yeah we,
to try
we do,
to do
we
that.
Do but it's so hard to get funding. Yeah. It's so hard, and we've got a GoFundMe, we've got a PayPal. Yeah. And it's so hard to get funding.
Okay, so take us, finish off taking us through the day.
Yeah, so anyway, so we'll do that, and then I'll cook them lunch, we'll sit round, have lunch, and then we'll go back and do whatever we need to do. We're not expected to do anything. And then we can reach out to our counsellors, Mitch Bryan, if the vets are struggling on camp. They'll reach out to Mitch Bryan. He's in Colorado. He's Mike 5 unit. He's now stepped up and does a military reboot program. So he has a course, and we do a course. And if veterans are in crisis, because he's in America, he's awake while we're sleeping, and we take it in turns. And yeah, so we'll do stuff like that. What else is it? You've got jacuzzis on camp. You've got a gym on camp. You've got walks, you've got animal therapy, you've got karaoke at night time,
a campfire type?
Yeah, we've got a campfire there where we all sit around, we light it up. We've actually got an event on this weekend. The big size doing, he's got his friends and coming along, and it's about networking. Mm. It's about bringing people together, networking, promoting this camp. Because like you say, they never reported on this raid. They never reported on this raid, and they never reported on saying it being NFA'd.
So, when you say NFA,
no further action. And
last question: what did they claim was going on there?
They claimed, I believe, they think we were. There was weapons on site. There was weapons on site, and we were a terrorist organisation. I think it's homegrown terrorism, but they didn't find anything. It's all been NFA'd. Now, you've had a daughter, and they've got their daughter's got children, a young child. recently just had a new one, so congratulations, Tia, on that. Not Tia, Dolly. You've got Tia that lives on site with her boyfriend as well. They all had to be moved off the camp. And they've got residents on camp. They all had to be moved. You had Mike Sloan on there. Oh, I want to touch on Mike Sloan because he's got a massive story to tell. Can I talk about it? So Mike Sloan, he's from Scotland, and he was one of the first people at the camp. He was assaulted in his own home. He got bite marks. He was attacked. He rang the police. The police did nothing about it. The guy came round again and attacked him. Mike defended himself and he killed him. He stabbed him. And Mike Sloan went to court. Joe and Dion supported him. He did 7 months in jail. He's now released because he was defending himself. He's now staying at the camp. He's struggling. He's really, really struggling. But he's such an amazing guy. And I've observed him. I've been looking after him the past couple of weeks. And he is a gentleman. And he would never have committed that act ever in a million years. If you knew this guy and you spoke to this guy, he would never have committed that act unless his life was in danger.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because we had last week Ronnie Barkan, who's he's Israeli born, he's an activist,
yeah.
And he has just got a suspended sentence as one of the Elbit Seven. Now, Ronnie is his argument in court that he wasn't allowed to use wasn't allowed to use, okay, in court. Yes, I know. Yes, you're scratching your head like me.
Yeah.
Well, because the judges these days will not allow these arguments. Now, he's saying that we're trying to stop the production of these drones in Britain to send over to Israel to kill civilians. And so their argument is supposed to be, anyway, and it's up to a jury to decide, we're doing a small crime over here to stop a greater crime elsewhere. So in a way, what you're saying about your friend at the PTSD camp,
yeah,
is very similar sort of situation.
Yeah, it is, yeah. It's absolutely crazy, isn't it? The system. I was going to swear that the system is screwed. The system is screwed. The system isn't looking after us. They're all lined in their own pockets. The rich are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. And I'm going to touch on this subject. It's the veterans. They saved our country. Why are we not saving them? Why are we housing migrants before veterans?
I like the way you bring up this whole point about the greater crime, because to me it's a crime that this is not supposed to be used in defence in court. I mean, back in the 1990s, there were a group of women that went into a BAE factory to disarm a jet or to damage a jet which was about to be sent to the dictatorship, which really is a dictatorship, yeah, in Indonesia.
Okay.
There was a long trial, blah blah blah, and after a couple of years, eventually on the 6 o'clock news and the 9 o'clock news, as it was in those days, they announced, oh, they've just been let off because the crime that they were preventing is a war crime. And so that's okay. So let's have a listen now. This is a little clip, it's only a short clip, from Ronnie last week talking about Elbit Systems, this arms company. It's an Israeli firm based here in the UK, and in fact their headquarters is in Bristol.
I've been collecting evidence for at least the year that I was under house arrest, showing the multiple connections. I have multiple proofs to show that Elbit is dead wrong in its false accusations that there is no connection between Elbit Systems UK and Elbit Israel. But let's start with the basics. The profits of Elbit Systems UK go to Israel because this is a wholly owned, this is wholly owned by Israel. I mean, this is what is happening in the UK is simply the Israeli operations in the UK of Elbit Systems Israel. As Tzipi Chotovelli, the Israeli ambassador to the UK, she, when she attended the inauguration of the newly opened site in Bristol, they built a new facility, a big one. She clearly stated that this was an Israeli factory which produces all these wonderful technology of murder for the Israeli army. Also, the UK ambassador to Israel was present in that inauguration of that facility. And obviously, the president and CEO of Elbit Systems Israel, who also happens to be a director of Elbit Systems UK, surprise, surprise. He's not the only one. You have usually a majority of Israeli high-ranking Elbit Systems Israel officials who are directors of the Elbit UK subsidiaries.
So that's Ronnie Barkan, who was speaking to us last week about Elbit and also about his activism. He's come to the UK. He says it's impossible, really, to be an activist in Israel anymore, even if you speak out about trying to not be drafted into the Israeli army because you don't want to get involved in the whatever's going on in Gaza. You can be jailed over there too. In fact, many people have been jailed, and then they get out of jail, they go straight onto the media in the rest of the world, and then they're put back in jail in Israel. So it's hardly surprising it's difficult for activists over there. But let's just chew down on this knotty topic, which is, what is the British Army about these days? What is the British Armed Forces about these days? Because you look at Martin mentions this many times, about the war memorials around this country, fighting for freedom in the Second World War, against fascism, against the Holocaust, against the total takeover of the whole of Europe by the Nazis. I think most people at that time could see this was a just war. It's a bit more difficult to untangle things like British support for the Israelis in Gaza, for the Ukrainians, as just wars.
Okay. Well, what is the British Army about? I joined the British Army. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I was Royal Signals, I'd say, 4 years. I actually got discharged from the army for possession of 1.2 grams of amphetamine that wasn't mine. I fought my case. I did 3 years it took me to fight my case. I got my caution overturned. I've got all the paperwork and all the evidence to prove. They then offered me a £146,000 settlement, which I bought an old RAF house in Wittering, and I got 8 years service, even though I only served four. The army, I don't think we should be fighting anybody else's war. We shouldn't put our soldiers fighting. Tony Blair is a war criminal. Tony Blush is a war criminal. And would they put their children on the front line? No, they wouldn't. And then, I can't remember this guy's name, but I saw this program, and one of these MPs one of the guys was speaking to the MPs and said, no, sorry, the MP stood up and goes, these soldiers are doing a fantastic job. They do an absolutely amazing job. Take my hats off to them. So one of these guys stood up and goes, well, do you have children? And the MP said, yes. So why didn't your children join the army? And not in these particular words, he basically said, my children ain't that stupid. Now, he made himself look a complete prat.
Something's changed. You know, this is one thing. I mean, I was looking at, for example, at the Remembrance Day service back last November, and looking at the and looking at the veterans from there who were in their 80s, etc. And there was a real attempt to try and say, well, the wars that we're involved with now are just wars. They're wars for the freedom of humanity. Something's changed since World War II, hasn't it?
We had a World War II D-Day veteran, Alfred Grenegal. He was from Dorset. He was served a no-fault eviction notice, yeah? He was 98. He was in the paratrooper regiment. He was one of the first landings in Normandy. They give him a no-fault eviction notice, yeah? So I took... Joe and Dion made a GoFundMe. I was in Pembrokeshire at the time, so I did a Hike for Hero. If you look online, Hike for Hero. To get this guy housed, okay? Because we went to visit him, me, Joe, Dion. We all went to visit him, and John Lawrence and my mate Kyle. And it was rough. It was filthy. It was rough. And me and Joe broke down. We were in tears. The condition he's living. That guy saved our country. So we did a Hike for Hero from Pembrokeshire to Tenby, and with the GoFundMe and the PayPal, we raised £12,000. We managed to get him rehoused. Now, it shouldn't be down for people like the PTSD camp or myself. It should be the government. And if you went to that hostel and seen the conditions he was living in, it's disgusting. Now, Alfie died about a week and a half ago. He sadly passed away. We did a memorial service for it at the camp, and his funeral's next Friday. And I just want to say I'm so sorry for your loss to his family and friends. Because Alfred was an amazing guy, an incredible guy, and we're really saddened by his passing. We really are.
So, going back to this raid, finally, I mean, I think we've talked most about it, but, I mean, what was the after effects of it on the camp? Because it must have been pretty horrific. You've got quite a little ecosystem going on there, and suddenly, you've got the might of the Metropolitan Police anti-terror squad descending on you.
Well, I think more people should be helping Joe and Dion, or more people should be helping, because Joe is affected by this, and I've known Joe for many years now, and you know, his husband Dion served a long time in the Paris, 20-odd years, and served 13 years in Iraq as close protection. And I think Joe is suffering PTSD from this raid. I really do, because it's really affected, because seeing her husband being held on the floor with a gun to his head, because he was special force, he was in free para, and his children being evicted off site. They spent 2 or 3 days in custody for absolutely no reason. She'd been worried about him, worried out of her mind about her children, and she talks about this all the time, and she's not the same woman as she was before. I love Joe dearly, and Joe, if you're listening, I love you dearly. But it's affected them massively. It's affected, you can imagine the publicity online. They could have shut this camp down. That probably was their aim. But we are coming back. We are fighting stronger, and we will not give up on our veterans, and we will not let the government or the police take us down.
It's funny, I can remember chatting with Ian Mattison. He was an old contact of mine that died a few years ago, but he was in the Royal Engineers. And Ian had set up a veterans charity, Soldiering On, I think it was called, and he had some load of people taking legal...
Is it Soldier On or Soldier A to Z?
Soldiering On, I think it was called. And he had a bunch of people took legal action to get him shut down.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, well, you're not one of the official charities, you know, like the ones that Rupert Murdoch patronises, and so you're not allowed to exist. Anyway, you do have events down there. You talk about something called the Big Brother Veterans.
So basically, me...
Big Brother? Yeah. I mean, this is that great guy that stares at you in 1984.
Well, no, Big Brother. You know, everybody knows what Big Brother show on telly.
Oh, right.
So we come up to raise money for the camp. I've come up with it. I own a show with Joe, the camp, Joe and John Lawrence. I'm going to say it, National Housing Party UK. Big shout out to John. We host a show. Me, John, Joe and Mitch Bryan from Colorado, Mike 5 Unit. It's called The Late Night Veteran Show. If nobody hasn't seen it, get online. We're on Facebook, we're on YouTube. We've got 12 platforms. Give us a like, give us a subscribe. We get veterans on to talk about their story. We've had Andrew Bridgend. He's a veteran. He's an MP. We had him on a show, and that gives us good publicity. Because it's really good public. We've had Piers Corbyn on tomorrow night, so tune in for the show. Piers Corbyn's friend is a veteran, so we like to have a veteran on as well, coming on. That's what the show's all about. But we're trying to reach out to veterans, because let me tell you something. When I was homeless, you know, people, they don't like to, soldiers are too proud, they don't like to ask. They hide in a field or a wooded area.
Actually, Martin, didn't you know some veteran that was hiding in a field?
I know
somewhere.
A guy, I met him in a pub, and then it turned out he was sleeping in
a
wood nearby.
But let me give you a tip. If you see any veteran on the street, that they won't beg. They're too proud. And if they don't take stuff off you, let me tell you what to do. Buy them something, put it in a bag, leave it there with your name on. Keep doing that, and after 3 or 4 times, they will reach out to you. And I know this, and I know this is what will happen. So please, please act upon that way, and veterans will then come to you. And, you know, if you just walk through the streets and you see a homeless person or a homeless veteran, or just say hello to 10 people a day as you walk in, that could potentially help someone. Just asking if they're okay.
Okay. This business with GB News. Can you just tell us what happened there? Because you were about to be on GB News. Yep. You started to get into that tale.
We did. So me and Dion went down to GB News.
How long ago was this?
Probably a month ago. We arrived. Nigel Farage was sick, so he said he'd reimburse the money, refund us for our trip, and we'd come back on next week. We haven't been reimbursed just as of yet, so I need to get in contact with them. We came down the following week. Yep, show's going ahead. We got there, and there was riot vans outside, police cars, and Ofcom had shut us down and wouldn't allow us on the show. Although we'd been NFA'd for homegrown terrorism, for the raid and being classed as homegrown terrorism. I with the Penally camp thing, I was on a prevent course, prevent terrorism course. Oh, yeah. 5 years. 5 years they put me on that to be found that I'm harmless and I'm innocent. So this is what they do. If you're trying to fight, stand up for your country, you get classed as a terrorist. And we need to be looking at real terrorism.
So you've gone all the way to London, a pair of you, twice. Appear on GB News and told twice, go home.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
And Ofcom. The thing is, I would imagine it's their managers worried about Ofcom rather than
we looked
Ofcom
into
itself.
Ofcom. We looked into Ofcom, and they're owned by foreign nationals. So that's
isn't it
a
UK regulator?
It's a UK regulator. So I mean, in theory, they're supposedly independent, but of course they're controlled by the government.
Yeah,
so the government tell them what to do, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically we got shut down and we're really disappointed because we need this publicity. And Tony, I'm going to thank you because you're allowing us on your show. You're allowing free speech. And a lot of people won't allow us on because they think we're, you know...
You're a terrorist.
We think we're a
terrorist. Well, you look like a terrorist to me.
Yeah, well, times are hard, mate. Times are hard.
Yeah, but so is Martin, so we're in good company. In fact, you remember, Martin, the programme we did with the BBC after the 7/7 London bombings, where there was an attempt to frame us like two really dangerous characters because we were talking to the Muslims.
Wow.
I know, scary stuff.
All of these things, you know, it's difficult to get a serious dialogue going. Because everybody's got their, you know, they've all got their axes to grind, you know, and nobody's listening. They all want to tell everybody else what they think.
You're absolutely right about the modern world. Is people are not tolerant of other views for some reason. In fact, those are the sorts of people that seem to be being put into power.
Yeah.
Those that don't understand that everybody. And the other thing I love is this. I think it was Sandy Adams, the first person I heard it from, was this whole idea of the zero trust agenda. Now, who wants to live in a country where zero trust is the norm? You just don't trust. I mean, for me, I was always brought up to give everyone the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you may have some doubts about somebody, don't vocalise them unless they've proven to you that they are dodgy in one way or another. But you mentioned that you were in Signals, and it's funny because I'm just in the middle of... Next week is we're going to be... I'm going to be uploading it, the full... thing, which is a visit I did to the Royal Signals Museum in Blamford Forum.
Blamford, Dorset 11 Signal Regiment, yeah.
It's a fantastic little place.
Yeah, it is,
if anyone is interested in a bit of history. And so let's have a listen to that now, a little excerpt from the piece which I'm going to be releasing next week about the Enigma machine.
The Special Operations Executive and Enigma and codes and code-breaking. And this is all sort of secret agents, spies and codes and what have you. Obviously, one of the proud possessions of the museum is the Enigma code machine. Everybody knows about the Enigma codes. We are the proud owner of one of them. And obviously, we try and tell the story, the whole story of the Enigma, how it works physically or electronically, how it works, how it was used, how the messages were intercepted by people like the Y service. Enigma was actually invented by the Poles pre-war, but essentially the Enigma code machine was the code machine used by the German army or the German military. I think there was a naval version, an Air Force Luftwaffe version, and an army version. And they set codes on different wheels, which would then click over. So if you repeated the letter A, every time you press it, it would come out as a different letter. And therefore, they considered the whole code system, and I'm not a great expert in how the system works itself, but the whole system to be almost unbreakable. In fact, it was something like, I think, 32 billion or million different variants before they could break it. And this was used to send messages by the German Army, Air Force and Navy. Essentially, what happened is Alan Turing, who is based up in Bletchley Park, who is a mathematician, started intercepting the codes, but couldn't initially break them. So all sorts of mathematicians and scientists were gathered together at Bletchley Park, and it was their job to break those codes. And it culminated in the invention of something called Colossus, which was the world's first digital computer, but using radio valves. And when they first came up with the idea, they actually didn't think it would ever work because radio valve technology was so fragile that they thought the tubes would keep blowing. But actually, Tommy Flowers, who is a BT engineer, or what was British Telecom at that time, I'm not quite sure.
Post office, probably.
Probably the post office, suggested that actually the only reason valves break in normal people's radios is they're moving about all the time. So that once you have a static position with these valves, the technology is actually quite robust. Essentially what this ended up with is a digital computer using Colossus and things called bombers, and they would get the information intercepted by people called the Y service, which were some of them raw signals trained, quite a few lady operators in all sorts of different places around the UK, and they would intercept the messages. This raw material was sent to Bletchley Park, and then the code breakers would attempt to break it.
Now, speed would be of the essence in that sort of situation, wouldn't it? Because if there's any point in knowing what the enemy's about to do, you've got to be able to act on it quite quickly. You can't wait for sort of days for people to go through all these mathematical formulas.
In essence, you're right, but some obviously would be, when you're planning any big push within the military, you've got weeks of planning ahead of it, and therefore you'll get this, all of a sudden, this rush of communications. The short story is that what they found is they could break the codes, because a lot of the time the German operators who were sending the codes, who were told never to do repetitive signals, because once you do a repetitive signal and you know what that signal is going to be, like hello, then every time they type in hello, it gives you five of the code letters that you're having to break. Now, obviously, Germans, during the war, being what they were, a lot of their messages would either begin or finish with Heil Hitler. So this automatically gave the code breakers a head start in breaking that particular code, because the codes would change every day. So it wasn't just a matter of breaking the code and then you could interpret everything. They had to re-break it every time it was sent. Although they did find that actually these codes weren't changed as regularly as they should be. So we tell the whole story of that, what operations were affected by it, in little interactive areas where the public can actually type in a code on actually a computer, but that shows you how the Enigma machine actually worked, which is great fun.
So that's the Royal Signals Museum, a little extract from there, which I'll be putting up next week. That is down in Blandford, well worth a visit. But the reason I like, I mean, this is sort of a legend, this whole business of the Enigma machine. And I'm a little bit concerned that something's going on here that we're not necessarily aware of. That is to say, right the way through World War II, we had, and maybe someone from the signals, you'll be familiar with all this, the British had broken the codes at the early part of the war, but they didn't want the Germans to know. So they were listening to what the Nazis were planning to do, where they were planning to move troops. And there's this famous phrase, we're playing God.
Yeah.
Because,
I was Royal Signals electrician. I wasn't on the comms. So we were part of Royal Signals because we was electrician on the generator side. We'd service the generators. We'd set out the power from three to one phase boxes, two phase, two to one phase, etc., and do the headquarters and stuff like that. So we weren't really too much on the comms. We were part of the REMI Light A detachment. So we sort of joined together, but we were classed as Royal Signals.
Yeah. So, and also it's quite, what I'm trying to say here is the idea was we had to not use the information or use the information we got in such a way that the Nazis, the Germans, didn't realise that we'd broken the codes. This was actually quite an awkward job, Martin, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of history involved in this. But, I mean, for example, I was an aide worker in Yugoslavia during the 90s, but in Yugoslavia during the 40s, they parachuted McLean in there to meet up with Tito and the partisans. Up to that point, the British hadn't been supporting the communist partisans in Yugoslavia. But they knew from breaking the German codes that they were the most aggressive in killing German soldiers. That the other groups which were fighting the Germans, the Chetniks, for example, they were quite sensibly not going front to front because they knew there was going to be loads of reprisals on the population if they did. The communists, on the other hand, were much more, you know, we're just going to go at them and see what happens, you know. And the Germans found them much more hard to handle. Okay. And of course, the terrain allowed all of this to happen because it's very mountainous and they've got a tradition of this sort of thing. But anyway, they didn't want the Germans to know, because they had eight German divisions in Yugoslavia, which is quite a lot, you know, and they were tying them down, and they wanted it to carry on as long as possible from the point of view of everybody else fighting the war. But what they did is they sent Fitzroy McLean in, and then he came back and said, oh, well, Tito's the guy we need to support, whatever. But they'd already made their mind up to support Tito. But they didn't want the Germans to know that. So McLean's mission was to go there and show the Germans, oh, that's what the... McLean's parachuted in, he's met up with Tito, they've changed the policy because of that. But they hadn't changed it because of that. They changed it because they knew that they were holding down eight German divisions. It was pretty horrendous for the population, because, of course, the Germans carried out all sorts of reprisals. And eventually, of course, Tito's partisans were moving around inside Bosnia with loads and loads of camp followers, you know, like women and children. Because as soon as they've attacked the Germans in an ambush, they've got to take all the civilians with them.
Yeah, of course.
Because the Germans are going to come in and kill them all if they
don't. Yeah, of course.
So the reason I bring this up is because now it looks as if it's us that's the subject of the spying. This week, I mean, we've got Kevin Carhill as the former Sunday Times journalist we have on here from time to time. This is one of his, some might say, obsessions, but he's right to be obsessed by it, is this idea of the tech giants, the Googles, the Metas and the rest of them, spying on children. I mean, yes, they're spying on us, they're spying on our MPs, they're spying on our judges, they're spying on our journalists, but they're also spying on our children, which happens to be quite a serious crime under the EU Human Rights Act. So this week has surfaced again yesterday, Brussels saying that Meta platforms, social media sites Facebook and Instagram, will be investigated for potential breaches of EU law. Online content rules relating to child safety, says Reuters. EU regulators said on Thursday a move that could lead to hefty fines. Tech companies are required to do more to tackle illegal and harmful content on their platforms under the European Union's Landmark Digital Services Act, which kicked in last year. The European Commission said it's decided to open an in-depth investigation into Facebook and Instagram due to concerns they haven't addressed risks to children. Meta has submitted a risk assessment report in September. The Commission is concerned that the systems of both Facebook and Instagram, including their algorithms, may stimulate behavioural addictions in children, as well as to create a so-called rabbit hole effects, the EU executive said in a statement. So this is spying on us. What do you make of these tech giants? I mean, you know, you're on your phone just then.
Yeah.
We're on our phones a lot of the time. Certainly, journalists are. MPs are.
Well, I think if big tech can shut down platforms, they can protect our children, they can stop paedophilia, can't they? Do you know what I'm saying? That just goes with saying, doesn't it? If they can shut down, if big tech can and they're shutting people down, we're not allowed freedom of speech. That even when we were protesting, they were trying to shut us down, weren't they? Giving people 10 grand fines. Everybody has a freedom to protest. But if big tech can shut down platforms, they can almost do anything.
But if I'm Eric Schmidt or Zuckerberg looking at this, Martin, you know what I'm going to think? I'm going to think, yeah, we can handle a fine. We don't care.
If you're making enough money, then you can. That's what happened with the banking system.
But it's wrong.
Is controlled by the drug cartels control the banking system.
It's total
because
control.
Because also they're embedded with the CIA in Latin America. Everybody knows this. It's all
that's abuse of process, isn't it? It's abuse of power, really, isn't it?
Well, it is, and of course, but they do it because it works. You know, I mean, it's a system of doing things. Yeah. I mean.
But that's not fair with the people that haven't got money. Well, you can't fight against that, can you?
Well,
being shut down left, right, and centre.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about the way all of these systems. I'm using the banking system.
Okay,
I'm talking
a minute
about the tech system.
Yeah.
The way in 2009 there was a report from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And as a drug user, you will know why I'm talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he said, "Well, what happened there is as the banks started to wobble." All the drug cartels went straight to the top bankers and said, look, you're having a panic, aren't you? You've got no money. Guess what? We've got loads. And so all of the dirty money, which usually has to work its way through the system steadily, they just got sucked in one go. So the banking system was actually saved, A, by taxpayers, people like me and you paying our taxes, and B, by the drug cartels. And, of course, this is the system we live in. It's one of financial fraud at every level. And manipulation of all kinds.
Now, Darren, you've been saying right from the start this thing about the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
Sunday, in the Sunday Times, I don't really encourage people to buy it. You might find a copy of the magazine just sort of just hanging around in the supermarket that you might just decide to purloin.
Okay.
But it's got the rich list this weekend. And so I spoke to a former rich list journalist earlier, Kevin Carhill, about that. Particularly about the Prime Minister's massive wealth.
The Rich List is unusual, certainly when Philip Beresford was running it. It's based on company's house records, so it's not a cut and paste Rich List. It's substantially valid with odd quirks. Philip never included Murdoch. Murdoch gets a footnote. And that was probably wrong, because Murdoch actually spends an awful lot of time in the UK. But by and large, the Rich List is valid, as it's based on real data.
Rishi Sunak, his wealth has jumped on his wife.
In their case, it's family money, but he has quite a lot, which isn't clear in the Rich List.
651 million. I mean, this is quite a wealthy prime minister, isn't it? It's difficult to imagine him sort of looking out for the poor.
I think he's the wealthiest one for quite a while.
Well, there's another aspect to all of this. Well, we can talk about maybe Sunak and his wife in a minute, but the migrant hotel king has entered the UK Rich List today or this weekend, and he's amassed a £750 million fortune from the asylum seeker crisis. Graham King is said to be making around about £3.5 million a day from housing migrants.
Wow. Well, have you noticed about all the member of parliament and people that are in power? They're all foreign nationals. All foreign nationals.
Well, they're not. Not all MPs are.
Well, not all MPs, but you've got London Mayor. You've got is it Sadiq Khan?
Well, he was born in this country.
Yeah, I know. But you can see where I'm coming from. You've got Rishi Sunak. He was unelected. You know, I can't remember all their names off the top of my head.
Does it matter that these people aren't British?
It does matter, but are they supporting us? Are they supporting the veterans?
Is their loyalty to Britain, I suppose, is the question. Martin, well, what do you think if people are...
Well, I think we've got to judge each... You know, they're all different, and they've all got their own little foibles, and some of them are worse than others.
Well, they're all the same. They're all rubbish.
Well, you can say that, but it's like if you're interested in football, get Khan out. Yeah, he just won an election, didn't he?
Yeah, of course,
he just won.
Yeah, I know.
So this is the answer to that. I mean, this is how we got to.
But we've got an unelected.
Well, there's going to be an election coming up soon. From a football point of view, he's going to be
That we had a different system for electing the mayor this time, didn't we? Because the Conservatives have changed it back to first past the post.
Yeah, well, they're rigging it. Obviously, the system might not have gone in.
Well, Piers Corbyn, he went to go for mayor, didn't he?
He did.
He had the money, he had the funding. Piers is on our show tonight at 9 p.m. on the Late Night Veteran Show. Yeah. I went down to a meeting down there, and he had the funds, he had the money, and they shut him down.
Yeah, but he didn't get the money in time.
He stood.
He didn't get the money in time, didn't he? No, he didn't.
He didn't have the money.
Let's just make it clear.
Okay.
Because I did interview Piers about this just before the deadline, and he said, we haven't got the money in. We want to use someone else's money who did get the money instead of our money, and the Electoral Commission said no. He didn't actually quite get all the signatures he needed, but he didn't get the money.
Obviously, one of the things that does make it an unlevel playing field is if you are wealthy, you can buy politicians. It's quite clear that can happen.
If it's wrong.
Of course it is, but in Scandinavia, they've still got rules that political parties are supposed to be funded on the basis of what they got the last time round.
They're all lying in their own pockets, aren't they?
Well, it's not all. Some aren't, and some are worse than others. If you do that scattergun effect,
you miss sniping out the real culprits, the
real culprits, Rishi Sunak and Ashata Murty. Their wealth is now 651 million. It's just gone up since last year by 122 million. So these are the people now in charge, and one does wonder why the country's in such a mess. Maybe you don't wonder.
No, I don't.
And also, I wonder to what extent, and we'll hear from both of your opinions on this, to what extent the fact that you've got this super rich people running the country now has got to do with wars. Because if they're not looking out for us, mm-hmm. they're looking out for somebody else.
Yeah. Have they been to war? Do they know what it's like? Do they know what it's like to be poor? So someone that should run this country should be someone that knows that's been to war, that's joined the military, or somebody that's been poor, that's lived, that can't afford basic basic daily living. They can't afford that. Someone that's been there, in all them areas. You can't have someone that's in there that's got lots of money and running our country, because they don't know what it's like. We should be looking after the poor. We should be looking after the veterans. And it's not happening. Most of them are lying in their own.
Why not, Martin? Why aren't we?
Well, there's a big topic, because it's to do with the way the system's rigged, and it's been rigged since the 18th century. In a sense, you know, what we've got now is just the same old system we've always had. Veterans have always got a raw deal in this country. Yeah. They came back from the Napoleonic Wars, and they got nothing, you know.
It's wrong.
Well,
they
it is
came
wrong.
After the, first
you, after, the, after the First World War and the Second World War, because there was conscription in World War II as well, things did change quite drastically. It takes a war to shake everybody up, and the old way of doing things goes out the window.
War is just making money, isn't it?
Well, it's become like that now. What is going on now with the Western military-industrial complex? It's about creating. You see, the private companies that supply the weaponry are actually not. They're looking to make a profit. They're not looking to make the most useful piece of kit at the right price. And that's one of the reasons why the Russians are doing so well in the war they're fighting. Yeah. It's because they've got a nationalised arms industry. The generals decide what tanks they want, and then they make them. And nobody's making money off it. Mm. Whereas the way we've
shouldn't
got it,
be about money, should it?
Well, if, we
shouldn't
be at war. War's a bad thing anyway, but if you're going to fight it, you've got to do it properly.
Yeah, of course you have.
And it's not about making money out of it.
In the appropriate, effective way, yeah.
Anyway, one of the great things we're paying our Rishi Sunak for as our Prime Minister, even though, as you pointed out, he's not elected Prime Minister, he's someone who just kind of got in because Boris was elbowed out, and he's a total disaster. He's going to lose the next election for the Conservative Party, but there's nothing that the Tory MPs can do. In fact, they've decided now that it's pointless even bothering to stand. Something like 65 Conservative MPs have announced that they're not going to bother to stand because they can't get rid of Rishi Sunak. He's managed to embed himself in there and nobble the 1922 committee, who could trigger a leadership election through these various sex stings and things like that. So anyway, but if you hadn't noticed, this week there's been an announcement really from both the main parties, the Tories and Labour Party, of a kind of election campaign kicking off. So let's have a listen now to Rishi Sunak and his attempt to convince us that he's worth voting for, and we'll get your views after that.
We will reward hard work, because you don't get anywhere in life without hard work. So we're making the tax system simpler, fairer and more rewarding, cutting national insurance by £900 for the average worker, alongside increasing the state pension by £900 this year. We're raising the national living wage to end low pay, and we're reforming welfare to make sure that work always pays and our safety net is fair to those who pay for it. Not least because giving people support to get off welfare and into work gives them purpose, dignity and hope. And it is also the only sustainable way to cut legal migration. So a world-class education system, a dynamic, innovative economy, hard work valued and rewarded, that's how Britain will succeed in the future. That's how we'll grow the economy. And that's how we'll transform public services too. Imagine a welfare system where new technologies allow us to crack down on the fraudsters, exploiting the hard-working taxpayers who fund it. Imagine the huge opportunities to cut crime through technologies like live facial recognition, helping police catch wanted criminals, find missing people, spend more time on the beat. And imagine our NHS, still free at the point of use, but transformed for the future. A service staffed by tens of thousands more doctors and nurses, thanks to our long-term workforce plan, backed by record funding made possible by years of fiscal discipline, with far greater choice over where you can receive your care, made as simple as choosing what to watch on iPlayer. And I believe there will be no more powerful example of what all the forces of British dynamism, innovation, scientific discovery, and technological progress can achieve than this: to address finally the fear of one word that still lurks in the back of everyone's minds, that touches almost every family in the country, and that envelops our whole world if we or a loved one hear it: cancer. Yet even here, if we are bold enough, there can be cause for new hope. We already know that we can prevent most lung cancers, the UK's leading cause of cancer deaths, by stopping smoking. That's why I took the important decision to create a smoke-free generation. And with huge breakthroughs in early diagnosis and new treatments like the mRNA vaccine for skin cancer, I believe we can be just as bold and ambitious in improving rates of cancer survival. Because if we can bring together my vision of a country transformed with our world-class education system that trains PhD oncologists and apprentice lab technicians, and our dynamic economy that attracts investors and incubates the billion-pound biotech businesses of the future, our post-Brexit regulatory freedoms to approve trials in a safe but faster way, and the scale of our NHS to help us research and trial those new drugs in a way that no other country can, then just one example of the incredible achievements this country can make would be to make a generational breakthrough against this cruel disease and fundamentally change what it will mean for our children and grandchildren to hear the word cancer. So today, I've set out my vision for how Britain can succeed in one of the most dangerous, yet transformational eras we've ever known. The values that lie behind that vision are a new patriotism, a confidence in ourselves and in all that we can achieve. I refuse to accept the doomsterism and the cynical narrative of decline that my opponents hope will depress people into voting for them. And I reject those who insidiously question our history and our identity. I believe in that innate confidence in ourselves that has always run through our island story. And just as we're proud of all that we created, invented, and discovered in our past, so we can be confident and optimistic about what we will achieve in our future. My pledge to you is that I will create the conditions to make that possible, to help you fulfill your ambitions, to build the world-class education system that gives our children the skills they need to succeed no matter where they started in life, to create that dynamic, innovative economy that will give you the opportunity of a wealthier, more financially secure life for you and your family, to restore our sense of civic pride and national cohesion so that we can be secure in the knowledge that we are all on the same side. And above all, you can trust me to keep you and your family safe and secure from the threats we face at home and abroad. There are storms ahead. The dangers are all too real. But Britain can feel proud again. Britain can feel confident again. Because with bold action and a clear plan, we can and we will create a secure future. Thank you.
Okay, so that's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak talking earlier this week. Very strange that he's talking about how dangerous the world is today, but then he's criticising doomsayers too. So my point is, well, you're a doomsayer. And then he says this awful word, trust me, trust me. And what I do, I see a vision of the Jungle Book with the snake and the little eyes going round and round. Trust in me. Any politician that stoops to having to say, trust me, trust me, you really do think that they're... And I wonder whether that's the sort of speech that could be written by AI.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah. Artificial intelligence. Well, I thought I was listening to a stand-up comedian then there. But yeah, as you say, it was Rishi Sunak.
It's our very Prime Minister.
Well, it's what it is. These speeches get written for them.
Yeah.
Then they just read through it. I mean, promising people a cure for cancer. I mean, would you buy a used car from somebody promised? He's a Prime Minister, for goodness sake. Our Prime Minister's going to cure cancer? I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't try and find the cure for cancer. That's a pretty big thing to claim that you're going to do.
Would you buy a cancer vaccine from Rishi Sunak?
No way.
He's very, very high tech, isn't it? It's all about technology.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this tech is military tech.
Well, of course, and we're going to use this technology, the spy technology, to crack down on the criminals. But of course, you might be.
Do you think Elon Musk has got a lot to do with it?
Sorry,
Elon Musk.
Well, that's right. Well, I mean, all these billionaires are very powerful.
Yeah. They're hovering around. And let's be frank about Sunak. He really is an agent of Goldman Sachs, not of anything else. And the big private investment bank, these are the people that are very, very close to the tech giants, you know, your Metas, your Googles, the rest of them. And so I just get this idea that, well, this guy isn't really taking his orders from... even government departments, possibly even think tanks like the Resolution Foundation, mm. people like that, he's taking them from yeah. a vision from somewhere else, which is coming from, you know, many of these tech giant firms. So is there anything you think, is there anything simple we can do to improve, Darren, the level of our politics in this country? Because well, it seems to have sunk to an all-time low with this guy.
I think people need to wake up. A lot more people need to wake up, and a lot more people are waking up and seeing what's going on. Now, how can I say it? If what does it say about your country when you've saved the British Army and you leave the army and there's no support for you and they're housing migrants, okay? Can I give you an example, okay? So, say, do you have any children, Tony? Right, okay, so say you've got children, yeah, and your children are 16, 17, and they go and leave home, yeah? And they've left home, and 3-4 years later, they want to come back. Are you going to deny your children living with you?
Well, they can live in a kennel at the bottom of the garden.
You know what I'm saying.
Yes, of course.
But what I'm saying is that's what Britain... See Britain as our mother. We saved our country. They're housing other people before our own. And as a father, I would rather house my own first before helping others. No, that's just my
I mean, opinion. Isn't this partly, Martin, because the whole illusion of nations has just broken down? Through globalisation, there's very little much left of the nation state.
Well, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
No, Goldman Sachs are not a nation state.
And of course,
they are an international... I mean, you must have noticed globalisation taking over.
Yes, but it's also refracted through a political structure. So the United States, for example, calls for the closing down of tax havens outside their jurisdiction. Yeah. So if you start to lean on tax havens in the Caribbean, that's because Joe Biden's state of Delaware is saying, "Hey, you can put your money here. This is the place to put it." And of course, the financialization of society has caused a lot of damage. And of course, the bailing out of the banks in 2008 was absolutely grotesque, if you think about it. But the nation state hasn't disappeared. We're on the brink, potentially, of World War III. You know, this is where we're at. And therefore, there's no... When we heard Rishi Sunak talking there, he's talking about aspirational things. But at the other side of his mouth, he's saying, oh, and we are going to go to war with Russia. Because that's what the head of the British Army, Patrick Sanders, is saying. Now, what that means is you've got to organise...
We don't want to go to war with Russia.
Well, I mean, we say we're not, but we're drifting there. You know what I mean? Just by... Like the First World War, nobody wanted it, but you end up doing it.
But of course,
if you're going to do things like that, if you organise your society on a war principle, you requisition all the housing you need to house veterans and refugees. I mean, loads of Poles came to this country at the beginning of World War II. We had to find housing for them, and then we had to put them in uniform to go and fight. Yeah. And, you know, if you're on that sort of flex, then everything's got to be properly organised, and you've got to... for example.
Martin, you know, nowadays,
a fair amount of food.
Nowadays, there doesn't seem to be any interest in actually looking after ordinary people, whether they're army veterans or anybody.
Well, that's right.
This is an elite deciding they're going to have a war for themselves. And if the people don't join the army, well, they'll use drones or something.
Doesn't it go to show what Britain has become? When they're not looking after their own and putting others first.
I think we should be a little bit positive because there are wonderful people out there.
There are wonderful people out there, but I can't stress it.
Can I just make a point about the people coming in who are asylum seekers? The reason they have to be put in accommodation is because they're not allowed to work. Now, what they need to do is process them, decide if they are, you know, what they are, and then put them to work.
What do you
so
think?
So then
about
they
the homeless
can go and get their own house.
What about your veterans that are homeless that would love accommodation and free meals?
Well, they should have that anyway.
But they don't.
As you say, what you could say is if you've been a vet, they could be using MOD housing to house vets, couldn't they?
The system has failed them, haven't they? You're absolutely right. I mean, Canali Camp, they should have housed them there.
I think the veterans should be squatters and get well organised.
Well,
I think Darren's point that
the government are the people who should be doing it is important.
It's
the government who should have got the responsibility.
Absolutely,
And it's great that...
Soldier should be on the street.
No, exactly, and that should be part of the contract when you sign up for it.
And it shouldn't be the likes of Joe and Dion spending money out of their own pocket. Thousands. I see it day in, day out.
If we were living in a different world, you might be able to convince Rishi Sunak to put some of the extra money he wants to spend on defence into housing veterans.
I believe this is the most dangerous time that we've faced for generations. That's why we've made the decision
to increase defence spending to 2.5%. That's not an easy decision. Right? That is a decision that we've made. That's a choice that we've made. That's a priority that we think is right for the country. Keir Starmer and the Labour Party have been crystal clear that they don't believe in that. They will not match that choice. Right? So there's no way you can keep the country safe and secure from the growing threats we face. Iran, China, North Korea, Russia acting together. Unless you are prepared to invest in our defence. It's as simple as that. There's a very clear dividing line there, which I'm sure everyone can appreciate. And at the end of the day, when it comes to this question, right, his track record will tell you that. And I don't say this for political point scoring, but that is just the reality of the situation. He's someone who believed Jeremy Corbyn would make a good prime minister of our country, not once but twice. Right? Jeremy Corbyn wanted to pull us out of NATO, wanted to scrap the army. Multiple members of the government that Labour would provide don't believe in a nuclear deterrent. So I don't see how you can, with a straight face, say to the country, yes, I'm prepared to do what it takes to keep you safe. The evidence just doesn't suggest that at all. And it's because of that increase in defence spending that I can stand here and provide more support to Ukraine. And not just that, can say that that support to Ukraine will be provided for as long as is necessary to repel Russian aggression. Keir Starmer can't stand here and make that pledge. And actually, Labour Party and Keir Starmer not matching our investment on defence spending emboldens our adversaries. What do you think Putin thinks when he sees that? That he thinks the West isn't prepared to make the tough choices to invest in their security? Because Russia's economy has mobilised for war. He's continuing to be aggressive. We need to meet that aggression with strength and allied strength. And not to comment on individual conversations, but with actions, that's what we're doing. We've always led in NATO. The 2014 summit here in the UK, we set the 2% pledge, one of the few countries to meet it for a decade. And we're doing the same thing again now. A new baseline for NATO, 2.5% of GDP, that yes, other countries, I hope over time, will come to match, because an investment in our collective security is a right thing for this time. And Keir Starmer's inability to say that he will match it emboldens our adversaries and doesn't demonstrate leadership to our allies at exactly the time that that's what we need.
There's your pledge. 2.5% of GDP is going to go on defence. I mean, it's obviously interesting to hear who he's talking about supporting. I'm afraid it's not veterans. Mm. It's Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, it's not our war. And what's his name? Zelensky. He's prime minister and he's an actor. It's funny that, isn't it? Did you know? I don't think we should be out there fighting this war. We should let them go on. Are we out there? Well, sorry. Behind closed doors, we're supporting it, aren't we?
Absolutely.
We are supporting the war, and I don't think we should be. We've got our own problems. We have got our own issues to solve. And top of the list, we should be looking after veterans.
So the discussion there is what Sunak's there talking about is Russian aggression. We've heard this week about an assault on Kharkov. It always used to be called Kharkiv, they call it now. But this is a city in the northeast of Ukraine, which the Russians are pushing toward. I mean, the way I understand this, Martin, what the Russians have been saying on their own media, which a lot of which, of course, is banned here in the UK, is that the Ukrainians have been using these Western German, American and British long-range missiles from that part of Ukraine to fire into Russia itself. And so they've said, well, we know that these missiles have got a range of however long it is, 100 miles or something, so we're just going to have to come that distance into Ukraine to stop them firing them into Russia.
Well, I mean, there's obviously a lot of things. I mean, as you know, but you probably don't, I was on Russia Today for 8 years before it was banned in this country. So I was on talking about exactly these kind of topics. Yeah. And I used to work over in that part of the world, so that's why I'm on there. The situation is that in relation to the British support for Ukraine, I mean, David Cameron this week said we're going to give them £3 billion a year as long as it takes.
But what's Zelensky doing with the money?
Well, a lot of it is actually being
more
stolen.
And more money, it's being stolen. That was my point.
It's a very corrupt place.
But we're still giving them aid.
It's because the point is a lot of that money is going to come back to, and the US money that's been given to them comes straight back to the United States as contracts to supply weaponry. Yeah.
Madness.
And of course, a lot of that is stolen as well.
Like I say, they're making weapons, they're circulating it, they're making money off it, aren't they?
They're doing it for money. And of course, what the Russians are doing, because of, you know, they've got their cause here, they think that the Russian speakers in the East, they don't want to be part of the Ukraine. They're not Ukrainians. They never wanted to be. And of course, it could have been settled by peaceful means, and the possibility was there. But Boris Johnson went to Kiev and told them to fight on, and we'll back you all the way. Zelensky at that stage was saying, "Well, I'll just have to talk."
Well, at one point they were saying Ukraine are winning the war. Do you really think they're winning it? I think it's lies. At one point, Rishi
Sunak there was saying that Jeremy Corbyn wanted to abolish the British Army. Now,
he
never said anything like that, and this is just a lie.
Prime Minister, you
can tell it's an election coming. But there's lies like this going on. But he was correct about considering withdrawing from NATO. Trump said that too, as well as Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, indeed, I think we should break NATO up. I mean, it's turned into a huge boondoggle. It doesn't do anything apart from cause trouble. What should have happened in the 1990s?
There's pros and cons, isn't there? Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there's an argument about it. There's a strong inertia in carrying on doing what you've always been doing.
Yeah.
Something like that would be a big appeal.
Well, the latest I've heard is that there may be peace talks with Putin, but only if the Ukrainians join NATO, and that's a part
of... Well, that ain't going to work, because the Russians don't want Ukraine in NATO. That's one of the things they're opposed to.
I think Russia is scared of NATO getting bigger. I think that's the issue, isn't it?
This is porous.
And like you say, I see your point where you're saying it is causing drama and we should drop out of NATO.
I was watching Poroshenko earlier. This is the previous president of Ukraine. And he's saying, oh, yeah, we want peace, but we would have to join NATO as part of that deal. And so is that going to work?
Well, I think what's happened now is that the Russians were prepared for peace in 2014.
Ukraine joining NATO.
I think it'll cause havoc with Putin. Won't be impressed. He doesn't want us getting any bigger. He doesn't want NATO getting any bigger. And you're right, it is causing an issue. I think we should have just left.
Well, Ukraine could have been an independent, neutral country.
The problem is,
they're right in the middle there. They could have just been neutral. And everybody does business with Ukraine, and they're not on anybody's side.
The problem is the way that NATO has edged towards Russia. In fact, it's starting to get right up to the Russian.
Yeah.
And in the news today, Germany has deported 7 Ukrainian soldiers for wearing Nazi symbols, which of course is a crime in Germany. German authorities say all Ukrainian military personnel arriving for training will be explicitly instructed that it is prohibited to display any Nazi symbols. Germans deported 7 Ukrainian soldiers who were training in the country on Thursday over their use of Nazi symbols. This is reported in Germany. According to the report, the training of the Ukrainian soldiers was immediately halted after some were found to be wearing Nazi symbols. As part of this report, there's no pictures of these. I think these guys have just kind of run away with their tail between their legs. The German Defence Ministry has reported that as of September the 19th, 2023, 7,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been training in Germany since the start of the war. Early in May, it was reported Ukrainian soldiers would train in Germany and how to use the Patriot air defence system. Such a training course typically lasts between 6 and 9 months. So what are these, Martin, what are these Ukrainians doing wearing Nazi symbols?
Well, not everybody in the Ukraine, but a substantial minority, particularly in the West Ukraine, are very, very pro. I mean, they're basically pro-Nazis. Stepan Bandera, who's their great hero, was aligned with the Nazis in World War II. And the Western intelligence services picked up on these people at the end of the war, and they've been supporting them ever since. And of course, the Russians are very well aware of this because they've been watching all this, you know, with trepidation. Yeah. You know,
Putin was a spy, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He knows all about this stuff.
He's been all over the world spying.
Well, mostly in Germany, but of course, he knows
what's going on with the world.
Yes, of course, and he's got a whole apparatus to tell him as well.
Yeah,
of course,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And the way the Ukrainians are presented in the West is that they're just totally innocent. They've just been attacked for no reason. But of course, there was a coup in 2014 in Kiev where the elected government was booted out. A pro-Western government was brought in without any election. And then they immediately started attacking the Russians in the east part of the country and killing them. And then they organised themselves against that.
Big mistake, eh?
Yeah, it was deliberate by the West because they're trying to provoke the Russians into a fight. And to my mind, that's an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars. what did they die for? They died for us not to go around doing stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the Russians can see this because they fought in World War II as well. They took the brunt of it. Mm. 27 million people. We had Peter's speech at the victory parade last week on the show.
And also this exhibition in the Moscow's Red Square of captured NATO tanks.
They've captured loads and loads of NATO kit.
As I said last week, in the background there you've got these massive blow-up black and white photographs of 1944 captured Nazi tanks in Red Square. I mean, the irony is not lost on the Russians, is it?
Well, no, because, I mean, they've got a different media universe from us now. Because we don't find out what they're talking about.
They're in a bubble like we are.
They are in a bit of a bubble in Russia, but I think there's a lot of people speak English. Well,
they do get more
foreign. Most people in this country don't speak Russian, so you can't look at the general media.
No, of course, yeah.
But of course, a lot of
education. They shut down RT News, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, that's right, because that's
why. Why?
They didn't like what we were saying, okay. Basically. Because it was critical of what was going on.
What's going on, yeah. And of course, we should be entitled to know what's going on.
Well, we should be. I mean, we ought to know what the Russians are thinking, even if we don't agree with it.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I mean, it's silly to say we don't want to la la la, can't hear.
Yeah.
Because then you end up in a situation where you've. What's really.
It's a bit disrespectful, isn't it?
Can I just say, at this particular moment, it's very, very dangerous because the British in particular have been singled out by the Russians for being particularly belligerent. They know the Americans are belligerent, but the British in particular have been very, very...
Boris, it was, that scuppered the whole peace deal in April 2022, wasn't it?
The British ambassador was called in for being told a few home truths last week. Said, if you allow British missiles to be fired into Russia proper to attack our facilities and so on, we will fire back, and we won't necessarily be firing them back into the Ukraine. Mm. Maybe it's your bases in Britain that we're going to fire back at.
Yeah.
If you're going to hit our bases, then we're going to hit your bases. Now, of course, then we'll be at war. Then what are you going to do? Have you thought this through? Because they're prepared for it.
Yeah.
We're not.
Yeah.
Our veterans sleeping on the streets.
Are they trying to call his bluff?
They are trying to call his bluff, and of course that's really stupid of
them. It's really stupid, yeah.
I mean, there should have been wisdom in our approach to the whole collapse of the Soviet Union. I was 64 years old, and I was involved from 1989 going over there. It was a great opportunity for everybody to bury the hatchet, change the attitude, and at one stage Putin said, well, why can't I join NATO? You know, that's the obvious solution.
Yeah.
The Russian army joins NATO.
So let's just bring it back here.
Not what happened.
We've had Party A of the Uniparty sitting out their stall on Monday. That's Rishi, Goldman Sachs, Sunak. Rishi Rich on the rich list, even higher up the rich list this week. But what about the other side? What about the ones that are actually going to win? I mean, I don't think I've ever known a general election where the outcome has been quite so clear and obvious as this one. It's almost
Tony Blair versus almost as if it's fixed.
It wasn't as obvious to me. Maybe you were just a little bit switched on back in 1997, Martin.
Yeah, it was pretty clear.
Who knows? Maybe you still are. Anyway, so this is the yesterday's. In a way, I mean, I don't think they pitched it as an election launch, but this is the other party, and I was quite amazed to see that they had a lot of people from the Labour front bench at this press conference, but they also had a whole bunch of people from private industry, and here is somebody, I think her name is Tito, I'm not sure, quite sure who she is, but this is the way they're kind of spinning it nowadays, is they're having lots of people who are from outside who are Labour supporters and who might become Labour politicians in the future.
And I'm delighted to introduce Tito, who's going to talk about the difference teachers made to her life and the difference Labour wants to make to every life. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tito, and I'm currently studying at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I'm passionate about education, learning, and every child being able to achieve their dreams. One day, I want to be a part of a Labour government that provides opportunities for all, regardless of their class, their race, or their gender. Teachers are the backbone of our society. I'll always remember my form tutor and English teacher back in year 10 at Queen Elizabeth Girls' School in Barnet, Miss Kenny Dwyer. Miss Kenny Dwyer gave each and every student her complete attention, treating each student as uniquely gifted and worthy of achieving their dreams. She would start form time by asking each of us to think of something that we were looking forward to throughout the term. And in the face of impending GCSEs and the highs and lows of just being a teenage girl, we were able to start each day believing that our school experience was to be a positive one. Miss Kenny Dwyer asked each of us to share our career dreams. No matter how impossible they seemed, from astronauts to prime ministers, she told us that each of us could do it. She ended each form time by playing a song, which has still stuck with me to this day, called Something Inside So Strong by Labi Siffre. And my favorite verse reads, "Brothers and sisters, when they insist that we're just not good enough, well, we know better. Just look him in the eyes and say, we're going to do it anyway." Teachers like Miss Kenny Dwyer are our children's first steps in the ladder of inspiration and aspiration. The Labour Party's policy to recruit 6,500 new teachers in key subjects means that more children will be able to feel as empowered as I was in their classrooms.
So that's somebody by the name of Tito. I'm not convinced, Martin, by this. I mean, you work in schools. The Labour Party are saying we're going to recruit all these extra teachers, etc., etc. It's a great idea. Will they be able to just simply afford to do that?
Well, this is the issue: is where's the money going
to come from? And also, the management and the control of schools is now so much in the hands of these privatised academies, isn't it?
Well, all right, but we could have a whole topic about what's gone wrong with the education system. The real issue here is the money. Where's the money coming from? Rachel Reeves is the Shadow Chancellor. She said, "Well, the credit card of the country has been maxed out, and therefore we haven't got any money for anything." Now, that is just wrong. As an economist, as she is, she knows very well you can do anything you want to do if you put your mind to it. You've just got to cost it out. So, for example, you could say, veterans, we need to sort this problem out. How much do we need for that?
Yes.
And you can either print the money or you raise taxes to do it. And you've just got to bite the bullet and do it. And you can do it. But the reason we don't do it is at the end of the Second World War, the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. It's now less than 40% for wealthy people. So you can see why they've got less, less money for things. And of course, the reason why a 95% tax rate came in for the very top people is because if other people are dying in the battles that we're fighting, including civilians who are being bombed, you are going to have to do your bit. And you're a wealthy person. Your bit is you're going to pay for it. That's the deal. And of course, what's gradually happened over the decades is that sense of collective purpose has gone. So we're not all on the same side anymore in the way that we then were. And in actual fact, they thought, well, we'll try and get rid of this high rate of tax after the war. But they didn't. And it actually worked quite well because suddenly the government did have money. You know, the National Health Service was set up. All of these things were done. But it was done because the wealthy had to pay a lot more taxes than they do today. And everybody accepted it. And of course, what's happened since then is the wealthy have gradually said, well, we don't want... They've made it... Their non-payment of taxes has become a kind of, you know, well, you can't make us because we could all just go somewhere else. So you've got to, you know.
And as Mark Thomas said, we will drive you to the airport.
Yeah.
Martin, there's also another I find these quite strange in these political meetings and press conferences. A couple of people here now from the housing business, and this is from... not from a housing association, as I initially thought this guy popped up. No, he's from one of these volume house builders who's there, part of the sort of selling the Labour Party.
I'm Rob Boughton, CEO of Thakin, a house builder in the South East. I'm pleased to be here today to support the first step towards the growth mission. Recently, my company welcomed Rachel and Angela to one of our communities we have built. I was struck by how they understood the housing crisis and are committed to tackle it as part of the country's economic growth. I support Rachel's ambition to grow the economy, and I'm pleased to see Labour has put so much weight on economic stability, which is so crucial so businesses can plan ahead. They saw the new homes we are building, and they also saw the facilities and the infrastructure that needs to be put in place for people and communities to thrive. I know they want to see more quality, affordable, sustainable homes across the country, net zero homes fit for the future being built today. I welcome that target. I welcome the forward planning. House builders and business more widely will be able to plan for the future if there is an industrial strategy and clear, consistent direction. A successful country needs a clear plan, which is why I'm encouraged to see Labour's first steps being set out today. I support Rachel's ambition to grow the economy and keep taxes and inflation as low as possible. Key to this is delivering new and sustainable homes paired with the infrastructure needed to allow those communities to thrive. I welcome Labour's plans to reform planning regulation to support house building and infrastructure fit for the needs of our growing population. At every stage of our life, schools for our children, green spaces for our families, local shops for our communities, and appropriate homes for those looking to downsize but remain at the heart of their communities. Stability, certainty, economic growth and house building. It's a priority for Rachel, it's a priority for me, and a mission we share. So thank you very much. We now have a video from another prominent business CEO to explain why he supports the first step.
Hi, my name's Seb James, and it is my great privilege to lead the Boots organisation. Boots has, as you know, around 2,000 stores and pharmacies right across the country, and just over 50,000 team members. Some of the things that I think are incredibly important to a business like Boots. For me, first and foremost, it's stability. A stable economy provides the right platform for sustainable economic growth. And it's that real.
So this is what we're now getting with the Labour Party, which is corporate ads for Boots. And before that, a volume house builder, Martin. I mean, this is an interesting new version of Labour. It's very, it strikes me as it's almost like a business trying to sell its, you know, used cars or whatever.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, they are pitching to be the Conservative Party of old. We're in favour of business. We're not going to rock the boat. We're not going to increase taxes on wealthy people. Don't worry about that. And of course, they're looking as if they're going to win, but therefore they've got to get all these other people, Boots, the chemist, and all these other people have got to be kept sweet. But I mean, it's pretty weak considering the real crises we face socially in this country, like the veterans crisis, and then globally. You know, it's all sweet talk, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And so we've got. I've got another clip. We haven't really got time to play that as well. But we've got Jeremy Hunt. I mean, I know he's. People will say, oh, God, do we have to listen to Jeremy Hunt? But actually, he does. This is the Chancellor, by the way.
Pensioners are angry that they're being dragged into paying income tax. When are you going to look at the threshold? And also, you talked about the ONS, talking about the economy going gangbusters, inflation's about to fall. At this point in time, would you say that the UK's economic woes are in the rearview mirror?
Well, when it comes to pensioners, I think there could not be a more stark choice when you look at the record of the two parties. The Conservative Party introduced the triple lock. We have seen as a result of that the state pension go up by £3,700 since 2010. The Labour Party increased pension taxes by £118 billion, taking money off every single pensioner in the country. And what I say to pensioners is, we've cut national insurance this year, so for people in work, that will mean a £900 reduction over the course of the year. At the same time, because of the triple lock, we've increased the state pension by £900 this year. And if we're going to continue to afford to be generous to pensioners, as I think we need to be, because I believe in that as a Conservative, we should reward people who've worked hard all their lives, then we'd need to take the measures that will grow the economy, getting more people into work as these national insurance cuts do, grows the economy. That means we'll have more for the NHS, which is used for pensioners, and more for state pensions. The economic woes in the rearview mirror. What, you're saying I'm... That's what I'm... Yes. No, I... Well, look, the truth is that I do think we have turned a corner. Of course, it's going to take time for that to feed through into how people feel. But in a general election, people are very smart about making the choice that is the right choice for their family going forward. And if you look at a combination of our record, more investment, more jobs, more growth than nearly anywhere else in Europe, combined with the IMF saying we're going to grow faster than anywhere else in Europe, we have now, you know, the fastest growing sector, the technology sector, with the third biggest in the world. People can see that Conservative governments have done the right thing to create growth that means that families will be more prosperous going forward. Jason from the Mail.
Thanks, Chancellor. Just to go back to Sam's point, the gap between the state pension and the personal allowance is now about £1,000. It's due to get smaller every year. Can you rule out the basic state pension ever being taxed? And on your big sort of headline, it feels like we're in an election campaign now. I mean, you've politely called Labour's plans a myth. I mean, you're accusing them of lying about their plans, aren't you?
Well, calling them a myth is about as rude as I get, Jason. But frankly, it is a lie. I don't make any bones about it. It is fake news, and it is an absolute disgrace to try and win this election by scaring pensioners about a policy that is not true. And when it comes to taxes on pensioners, I would just say to every pensioner in the country, which is the party in British politics that wants to bring down the taxes that you and everyone else pays, and which is the party that we know will increase them? And today, you know, we have produced costings. These are very significant costings. They are done by Treasury officials. They demonstrate that Labour's policies will cost £10 billion a year more by the end of the next Parliament. And Labour will try and say, you know, that our policies are a little bit different in this respect and a little bit different in that respect, and therefore, you know, you can't believe these numbers. But we have taken these numbers from what the Labour Party themselves have said. We have been extremely cautious. I mean, independent think tanks think that the Green Prosperity Plan will cost over £100 billion. Labour themselves said a few months ago it would cost £28 billion a year. They're now saying it's going to cost £24 billion over the next Parliament. No one actually believes that number, but that is the number that we have taken in these costings. We've been extremely cautious about the numbers that we've taken. And even on that most cautious reading of these Labour numbers, they are going to have a £38 billion black hole. And, you know, these are done by the same Treasury officials that would advise a Labour government if they win the next election. So if they get into power, Treasury officials will look at what they've said, just as we have done, and they will come to these same costings, because it's going to be the same people who would be advising them, and they will say, how are you going to fill this black hole? And to anyone who's worried about tax, whether a pensioner or anyone else, I would say the only answer to that question is the Labour government would increase taxes as night follows day. The Conservative government will do the hard work to make sure that we don't have to do that.
He does quite a good job in dissing the Labour Party. But one thing that they're not doing, Martin, maybe you could say, I think this is so important, it's this concept of fiscal drag we talk about from time to time here, mm-hmm. which is where all of the tax thresholds stay the same.
Yeah.
So for, you know, the inheritance tax, the value of a house before you start to get tax, which means if your parents die and they're passing the house on to you, if the value of the house is above that amount, above that amount, you have to sell the house in order to pay the tax, so you can't pass the house on anymore. All these things, including income tax thresholds, are all staying static, whilst inflation has been going for the last 2 or 3 years like crazy.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that. If you allow fiscal drag, then that actually dampens inflation without increasing interest rates. So that's the reason why they do that.
It dampens inflation. Yes. How does it do that?
Because
by taking houses off people.
No,
by stopping people passing houses on to their kids. How does that help?
Most of the tax
help anything.
Most of the tax, inheritance tax in this country is incredibly low. The real tax is income tax.
As the house prices go up over £750,000, so they're getting caught by inheritance tax.
Yes, and they shouldn't be going up. Property bubbles with house prices rising. That's what's causing homelessness.
Well, why aren't they just putting up the thresholds? They just won't do this.
No, they're doing that because, listen, we haven't got time to go into all the aspects of the
I think they're just taking people's houses off them. People's wages. No, they're not.
They
can make up that money, as you've just said, to pay for social care out of nowhere.
No,
they don't need to take houses off people
You said
that earlier.
Yes, you can just print money, but there's always a cost and consequence of that. It's actually like playing football. You can go left, you can go right, you can kick it over the top, but it's a judgment call, and you've got to get the money from somewhere. Yeah. But at the same time, the idea that there is no money is an illusion. There's plenty of money. It's in the hands of the wealthy.
Because
that's what they've done. They've monopolised it. They've ended up with it.
They tax you on everything. And like you say, when your parents die and your house gets sold, you're taxed on that, the sugar tax, you're taxed on buying your food, there's tax on everything. I think it's disgusting. If you give a gift now, I believe, if you give a gift more than £5,000, you've got to pay tax on it.
I think the thing is...
But you could give several gifts.
The way the system works is that people are robbed at work before they pay taxes.
They are.
Yeah, that's the thing.
As well,
it's more fundamental.
Inflation goes up, and when you get a pay rise, you don't effectively get a pay rise because inflation's
up. That's right.
What this tells me is we've been beaten by the Chinese because their cost of living in China is peanuts compared to ours.
Well, that's because in China, you've got free healthcare. They've got free
masks and
free healthcare, all of this stuff, and that means that their wages can be lower because they've got free stuff. If you have to pay for it.
Everything's made in China, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's because they've worked, you know, they've done their bit to work their way out of being very, very poor.
How much money have they made on gloves and masks?
Well, I know, but I mean, the COVID thing, we haven't really got time to go into this, but we do discuss this every week.
Yeah,
we discuss it, but it looks like COVID was a deliberate biological warfare attack.
I believe so.
By the West on China, And then they reacted. Mm. We're all at war.
Yeah.
It's happening already.
Millions
are already dead. And it's because the 9/11 attack was carried out from inside the US security
force. Just talking about COVID for a second, it was a Pentagon program going
on. DARPA program
in Wuhan. So this is China and America. Maybe.
No.
We don't. You're not sure.
No, I'm not sure. Because
who actually did the deed of making this little virus? It could even have been Porton Down.
No, it could have been Porton Down. It's quite possible. But it's Jeffrey Sachs who was set up by the Lancet to look about where it came from.
Cold research unit. After the war.
You can escalate, but as Donald Trump would say, was China.
It was China. You got that accent absolutely right. Anyway, we're going to wind up hearing from David McBride. May not have heard much about him this week, but he's a big story over in Australia. He's an Australian Army whistleblower who's been jailed this week for leaking documents. He's helped expose allegations of Australian war crimes in Afghanistan. He's now been sentenced to 5 years and 8 months in jail. So I thought I'd go and track down an interview with him to see what he was talking about. And I found it absolutely extraordinary that he exposes what is a complete lie about a so-called hero called Ben Robert, who's been splashed all over the Australian press as a hero, but he found out this guy wasn't really a hero at all. And the interesting thing about David McBride was that he was actually a soldier who was whistleblowing on all this, and now, of course, he's in jail. So let's have a listen to that, and we'll get your comments before the break. Thanks very much.
I have a very special guest with me today, a very dear friend. His name is David McBride. He went into the British Army. He finished Sandhurst, which is like our equivalent of West Point in the United States. So he became an officer. And then in the Australian SAS, which is the Special Air Service. So these are special forces. He was a lawyer and he exposed corruption and war crimes. And they're trying to put him in jail for that. David, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm very happy to be back on. Richard, you have a particular place in my heart because you were one of the very first interviews that I did, long interviews with someone overseas. And
thank you. You're the person to ask, not only because you're a whistleblower, you were in the SAS, but you're also a lawyer, right? So can you just start out very simply by telling us who Ben Robert Smith is? Because I think there's a trend to market him as the most decorated Australian soldier alive, and he was in Afghanistan and he received the Victoria Cross. But for the people who don't know, can you explain who he is and why this recent ruling was so important?
Well, I'm interested to see my friends in the UK. It's had a lot of coverage in the UK, which is interesting. Not much in America. He was Australia's most famous soldier by far. He was the face of the Afghan war. And it is a very important case because a lot flows from this. He won an important medal in 2006. I'll just give people a painted history. Below the Congressional Medal of Honor, but just below. And then 3 years later, he won the equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. He also did a lot of press conferences. He's a huge bloke physically, very good looking. Women just swoon over him. He's like 6 foot, six foot six, like an American football player. Very well muscled, tattooed, but very well spoken. And, he gave a lot of press conferences and he was just generally, he was probably the most loved, you know, and he was even Father of the Year, and he would do, media appearances with, abused women, you know, and put his arm around them in a very paternal way. He was beyond, most. So there was no one else like him, you know. If he had stood for president, he would have been elected, put it that way. And there were always rumors about him in the military, and quite well known. But rumors are just rumors. And in 2018, the newspaper, two very big newspapers, equivalent of the Washington Post, I guess, in Australia, ran these huge stories saying, actually, first they used an assumed name, so it got everybody's interest up. They called him Leonidas. They said, you know, based on the Spartans. And it seems like they didn't choose that name randomly. It seemed like his whole ethos was like he kind of thought he was Leonidas. When he kicked someone off a cliff, he seemed to think that he was acting out some scene from 300.
So he literally kicked someone off of a cliff, an Afghan man. That's what the judge
says. Yeah, and it wasn't even a lot of his defenders say, oh, well, you know, he was just taking out Taliban you know, that's what happens in war. But that wasn't the case. This was just a random guy who had gone to the local village to buy flour and been picked out, and they'd asked, you know, you know, where are the Taliban? And this guy was like, no, I don't know any Taliban. And then they just killed him. And, so he wasn't, there was no suspicion that this bloke was Taliban. They were trying to, it looks like most of the things they did, and snippets of, for people who are in the military, you pick up on snippets of the story that go over other people's heads. Now, one of the things that came out, that other SAS soldiers, and this was another good thing, he was outed not by journalists, really, when they ran the story, but he was outed by other SAS soldiers who were every bit as brave, every bit as patriotic, or more so, really, because he wasn't what he pretended to be. And but they'd say they'd gone up the Congo with a reference to the Joseph Conrad novel or you know, the Apocalypse Now, a kind of mixture of both. Which meant that they weren't trying to actually kill Taliban. They were trying to terrorize the population by doing things, by just grabbing a random bloke, throwing him off the cliff. When this guy got thrown off the cliff, it was in full view of people. And they shot him when he got down the bottom. And when he didn't shoot Ben Robert Smith, according to the allegations, which has been proved, he didn't shoot the guy himself. He got other people to do it. And that wasn't an accident. That meant that they couldn't squeal on you. They were now involved. I mean, you told them to do it, but once they did it, they could hardly go and give evidence against you.
Ordering other SAS to do it at first, and then, I kept digging into this, and as you hinted, he told the interpreter to tell an Afghan to shoot this Afghan man.
Yeah.
Right.
In that case, he got an Afghan to do it. But there was another case when he got a rookie to do it.
Yeah, it's bloody.
But you know, he's complicit himself. I mean, he's saying you need to shoot this guy. There's a lot of sort of Hollywood references because it reminds me of that a movie which I really like, the Brad Pitt movie Fury, where they do that when they've got a guy. And there's in that movie you can see that there is some sort of justification when you've got a young rookie who is he's not prepared to fire on children.
The thing in this case, it
wasn't justified. You know, it wasn't
justified.
So, although it's Ben Robert Smith from the Australian SAS that's been ordering these executions of civilians, it's actually somebody completely different, David McBride Martin, that's gone to prison.
Yeah, well, I mean, they said
for daring to mention
it's simply unfair, isn't it? He shouldn't be.
It's totally unfair, and of course, it's the reason they've done it. I mean, you'll go in a minute. Yeah, they've done it is because under the Australian Constitution and the US Constitution, you're not allowed to disobey a lawful order. But I believe in our legal system, you're actually, you know, we had Ben Griffin on here, who used to be ex-SAS, and they do Geneva training. You are absolutely entitled as a British Army soldier to disobey an illegal order.
Yes.
In fact, you're expected to do it.
Yeah.
That's what we expect.
Yeah.
But of course, this is exactly what's wrong with this. And of course, people can say whether the war with Afghanistan was right or wrong or whatever. If you go around doing stuff like that, killing a random person in front of a huge crowd of people, you're going to lose the war. And guess what? They did lose it.
And do you know what? They didn't care because they went in on a lose scenario. They didn't intend to win. And actually,
I think they did.
No, Martin. No. Vietnam was a lose scenario too. They didn't intend to win. It's disputable, but they went in to lose. And the main object was actually to gain to change geopolitical tectonic plates so the Americans could take over from the French in controlling the supplies of opium that were being grown in Southeast Asia. That's another way of looking at it, whether you agree with it or not. But there's loads of other things going on, not necessarily attempting to win in Iraq or Libya or anywhere like that. They're not nearly necessarily trying to win anymore. And the effect of this, and it will just end before the break on this, is it actually, Darren, surely, this sort of thing acts as a recruiting sergeant for the enemy. Yeah. And it's the same sort of thing that's been going on with Hamas in Gaza. If you slaughter a load of civilians, then the ones that are left are going to think, right, crikey, we're going to have to pick up a gun then.
Yeah, but that's not fair. The guy was an innocent guy that got killed. And this guy's out there speaking the truth, and they're trying to hide that. They didn't want him to expose the truth, and he's jailed. Now, if you lie in court, you get a higher sentence, and this guy's being jailed for speaking out the truth. I think it's unbelievable. Absolutely disgusting.
Well, I think he's going to be vindicated. He's actually quite a strong character.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I will take this punishment, but I'm in the right and you're in the wrong. Yeah. And the history Good books will the Good history books will say
this story needs to get out there.
Yeah, it's another miscarriage of justice. Anyway, Darren Edmondson, thanks ever so much for joining us. We want to just plug the PTSD camp one more time and explain to people what it is and where it is and how to find it.
Yeah, so PTSD camp is in Bath. It's Norton St. Philip. We've got facilities there. We've got a bunkhouse where the veterans come and stay. We're one of the only free veterans facilities in the country. So we've got a bunkhouse where the veterans can come and stay with their families as well. We've got bushcraft that we do down in the wooded area. We do karaoke. We've got horse riding, donkey riding. You've got animal therapy. We've got a woman that does Reiki that's offered to do Reiki and massage therapy for free. We've got Mitch Bryan from Colorado, which does a reboot military program, military reboot program. We've got another counselor called Roy Bates, served, I think, 20 odd years in the Marines, and he's now a counselor for us. So we've got two counselors, and over the past, since after the raid and since I've been involved, I'm not blowing my own trumpet yet, and Joe and Dion has told me myself, since I've got stuck in, the camp has come a long way. I'm working hard because I was homeless. They saved my life. And if you're listening, guys, thank you so much. Because you have actually saved my life. I went down a bad path, like I said, taking cocaine, and it took over my life. But you guys never give up on me. You guys never doubted me. If you can save my life, and I've learned that lesson from you, I'm helping other veterans and saving their lives. Now, it's just a case of reaching out to veterans and say, you're not alone. We are here. Together, we are stronger.
And I'll put a link up to the PTSD camp at Norton St. Philip up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later.
Like many universities in the UK, the institution I work for has had a bumpy few years. In the middle of intensifying workloads, redundancies, and a burgeoning student mental health crisis, the university's programme of well-being events has become a source of dark humour for me and my colleagues. Worried that your career might be over? Why not try chair yoga? Stressed about the student who stopped replying to your emails? Come along at lunchtime to paint some pebbles. I recently downloaded the university's new well-being app, which has a little SOS button for the times you're really struggling. When I clicked on the button, it took me to a conversation with an AI chatbot, which encouraged me to take deep breaths, stop worrying about the future, and focus on the present moment. I couldn't decide whether to laugh or cry. The present moment is exactly what's stressing me out. Like many people I know, I've been finding it increasingly difficult to keep paying attention to the news each day. All the stresses and worries of my own life pale in comparison to the horrors I see every time I look at my social media feed. It can feel almost obscene to carry on living while unimaginable horrors are unfolding at this very moment. To write a shopping list and do the washing up as mass graves are being dug. To plan my lectures while university buildings are being blown up. To worry about fitting in my marking as armed police are marching onto campuses and my academic colleagues are being arrested, killed and tortured. Lots of people I know are deciding not to have children, in part because they're worried about the state of the world that they'd be bringing a new person into. But I've been thinking a lot lately about something someone I know tweeted. How can anyone bring another person into a world like this? I don't know, man, he wrote. Me and my daughter went for pizza and ice cream earlier, and it was an absolute delight. And if we get nuked tomorrow, I'm glad we got to do that. The horrors unfolding on the news each day are so unbearable, precisely because life is so precious. What do we fight for when we struggle for a better world, if not for the small but joyful possibilities of human life? To fly a kite, to splash in the sea, to share a meal. May we open our eyes and our hearts to the immeasurable holiness, the unfathomable beauty of the fleeting moments of which our lives are made. Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, heaven and earth are filled with your glory. Hosanna in the highest. Amen. Soviet, Mr.
magic spell. That's a little bit naughty, Roger. But anyway, the it's not a magic spell, folks. No, the preacher will. Although I suppose some of them do, and so we'll be hearing from David Livingston about that at the end of the programme. So we heard there, that was from 1973. Little Tony was 11 years old, doing his 11 plus, which Martin probably didn't approve of when that was being released by Pink Floyd. And that was an interesting and exciting time. Just a couple of years after the moon landings, everyone was looking and thinking around. And for me, listening to that, I'm thinking about The Dying God, David Livingstone's book about the dying god and the sun and the moon and Isis and Osiris and all this kind of thing, the stuff they used to believe before they started, the Jews, Moses, the rest of them, started to enlighten the world as they were supposed to do. And these interesting, because I mean, yeah, so David Livingstone's just come out with this new book about Zionism. We'll be hearing a little extract from an interview I did a couple of weeks ago, which I don't know why I didn't quite twig. I think he's kind of talking above me. I can't quite understand. And if I listen again and again, I get it. So we'll be hearing that clip about Wagner a little bit later on. And before that, that was 1973, as I said. Before that, we had Sting and Russians. Great song from 1985 that you never hear on the BBC anymore. And for all sorts of reasons, like we're not allowed to like the Russians, or the Russians don't love their children. They're just evil nowadays. And before that, we heard from the Daily Service, today's Daily Service, more getting the BBC making it more and more awkward to hear the Daily Service, and that was Dr. Marika Rose there. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist and Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. This week, Martin, we've got to start with this FICO assassination attempt, the Slovakian, I never know if it's Slovenia or Slovakia, but it's Czechoslovakia, so it must be Slovakia.
Yeah, it is Slovakia rather than Slovenia, you're right about that. Well, it's obviously, they've got somebody who fired the shot, a 71-year-old poet, who's very much of, you know, he's opposed to FICO's politics, so there's definitely a political motivation behind it. And it's because FICO is very, very tepid on war with Russia about Ukraine. He basically says we should stop supporting Ukraine. It's a waste of money. They've lost anyway. And it's just provocative. We don't want to do it. So this guy shot him and tried to kill him. It may be that he's a lone actor. Or it may be that there's more to it
than
that.
Do you really think that?
Well, I don't know, Tony.
Well, he's been hanging out with Ukrainian Nazis.
Well, okay. Well, I mean, obviously it's a developing story, and I spend most of my time at work with children. I don't have time to check the internet and what's been happening the last 24 hours.
Okay, fair enough. That's okay. Now, so just a news story about FICO. A couple of years ago, 2021, Slovakian police arrest former Prime Minister, as he was at the time. Now, this week he is Prime Minister, although, of course, he's in hospital right now. Thank God he survived it. Imagine, amazing, really. Three bullets, or was it five bullets, they're now saying. And yet he's managed to survive. So thank goodness for that. And well done for everyone praying for the Slovakian Prime Minister over the last week or so. So this was back in 21. He was arrested by the police in Slovakia.
This is the shooter.
No, this is the Prime Minister, FICO. This is what they've been putting up with over in Slovakia. The former Prime Minister, Robert FICO, was detained before a protest defining coronavirus restrictions. FICO's a vocal critic of anti-COVID measures in the pandemic-hit country. So the police on Thursday, this is back in 21, arrested former Prime Minister Robert FICO in front of a live television audience when he tried to give a statement to the media to start a protest despite restrictions on crowd sizes. Even medium-sized public gatherings are currently banned in Slovenia, which has one of the highest coronavirus infection rates in the world after a record surge in November. So this gives you a bit of an idea of the background of this fella. What do you make of the politics of all of this then? This is your part of the world. In fact, if RT was still broadcasting properly, Martin, they might have phoned you when this happened to ask you what you make of it, mightn't they?
Well, I think He's been prime minister three times, so he's a well-known figure in Slovakia. He's regarded as a left of centre rather than right
it
of centre.
Isn't his the biggest party? It is, isn't it?
He's got the biggest party, but of course they've got a proportional system like most sensible countries.
The Labour Party will be running this country. They will probably only be the biggest party.
That's right. So but similar, of course, in Slovakia, it's because it's a proportional system, as all East European countries adopted a proportional system, including the Russians. He's got to form alliances with other smaller parties, otherwise he can't be the prime minister. But he's managed to do it. And the significance, the more recent significance of his political stance, is that he is one of the figures in Eastern Europe, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who's very, very, very cool indeed on going to war with Russia about Ukraine. And don't forget that Slovakia, and I think Slovakia does in fact abet the Ukraine, I'd have to check the map, Hungary certainly does. And of course this is their near neighbourhood, so the last thing they want is to get dragged into a war, right close to where they live.
Well, their attitude towards it
is much more sensible than people
think. It's easy for the Americans and the British.
It's
easy for the Americans and the British to say, oh, this is a great idea, Ukraine is going to win. Chuckle.
Well, exactly.
But these guys are much closer to the front line, aren't they? Well, they've got to have a little bit more reality.
That's right. And, of course, the Hungarians in particular, and I think that's true also of the Slovakians, they're dependent on Russian gas to keep their population, warm and to keep their industries going. So, the only way that the British, for example, could force the Hungarians or the Slovakians to change their attitude is massively increase taxes on here, not for our veterans, but for the people of Hungary and Slovakia, because they've got to they're the ones that have to make the big sacrifices if we're going to have sanctions on Russia. I mean, the Americans are calling for sanctions on Russia, but they don't do any business with Russia, hardly. So the sanctions on Russia don't affect them at all. It's countries like Slovakia and Hungary that are affected by that. And of course, he represents a general groundswell of opinion, which is saying that this war's lost and we shouldn't be throwing good money after bad, etc. The stuff I've been reading suggests that it's quite likely that this assassination was linked to the SBU, the Ukrainian Secret Services, because they've been going around assassinating people quite a lot in recent years. They assassinated Dugin's daughter, trying to kill Dugin as the Russian philosopher. They assassinated the journalist in St. Petersburg with a blow-up statue. They assassinated Zarkachenko, who is the prime minister of the Donbass Republic, as we heard from Donbass Republic, in 2017, with a bomb in a light fitting in a restaurant. So they do these things.
I thought it was in the corridor.
It was in the corridor, but the corridor of the restaurant. But the point is, the idea that the Ukrainians don't go around whacking people they don't agree with is simply wrong. There's a pile of evidence suggests that they do. And the obvious first suspects to look at here are the Ukrainian SBU.
So one of the best little commentaries I've seen on it over the last couple of days is from a guy called Dmitry Medvedev. Wasn't he actually
Russian president for one term? Yeah.
So he was told and trusted, look, you're going to be allowed to do this, but it recycled back to Putin again.
Yeah, because of the Russian constitution at the time didn't allow Putin to serve a further term.
Isn't it really kind of a monarchy, Russia? Really?
Well, traditionally it was a monarchy, but I don't think Putin is, the Russian political system has evolved quite dramatically since the changes in the early 90s, and it's gradually evolved into quite a useful piece of kit in which people do get a say, and there is freedom of speech to a very wide extent, but it also works because they've worked out how to play as a team.
My impression of Russia, if you just want to like take a long view from the moon, is that Putin has decided that he will allow all sorts of like gangsterism to go on. He probably thinks of himself a bit as someone who will break the rules himself from time to time, but he wants to make sure that all of that takes place well away from the Kremlin. So if the various gangsters in Russia decide that they're going to try and interfere in politics, he won't. And we've just had this thing recently in Georgia, haven't we, over this law to prevent foreign funding of NGOs in Georgia. So
it's not to prevent it, they've just got to say what funding they're getting. It's a demand for transparency.
Really? I thought it was
it's just exactly the same as the law they have in the United States that people aren't allowed to influence our politics from outside, except the Israelis just pour money in and put everybody inside.
So what what's the problem with Georgia then?
Well, the reason is that the Georgian government, the politics in Georgia, Shevardnadze was the, when Georgia became independent of the Soviet Union, Shevardnadze, who had been Soviet foreign minister, he took over as the kind of, you know, the main man in Georgia. And the West didn't regard Shevardnadze as sufficiently anti-Russian. So they organized a color revolution against him, and they put in their little protege, Shakashvili. And Shakashvili also turned up in the Ukraine after 2014 and was given a job of governing the Odessa region, even though he wasn't Ukrainian. So the Georgian government now are very wary of going to war with Russia to keep the Yanks and the British happy. And that's quite a sensible position for them to take. If you think about where they are, they're being used as a way of getting at the Russians, but they're going to have to live with the Russians forever and ever and ever. And they're not really interested in
necessarily have to live with the Americans forever.
Well, no, because the Americans live thousands and thousands of miles away, and the British, you know, thousands of miles away, but not so far.
Anyway,
able to help people. If the Russians came into Georgia, nothing the British or the Americans could do could stop them. So the Georgians quite rationally say, well, we've always been friendly with the Russians. We've had a bit of a tension with them. If the relationship between Georgians and Russians is a bit like that between the Irish and the British. There's been tension, but at the end of the day, we've always been neighbours,
with Chechnya, actually.
Yes.
In fact, many of the Chechens are now fighting with the Russian army in Ukraine.
Indeed.
Anyway, look, back to Medvedev, because he did, I thought, an excellent little tweet about this business of the FICO assassination attempt. Is it really surprising, he says, that for the first time in decades in Europe, there was an assassination attempt against a prime minister who held a sensible stand on Russia? And not a pro-Russian one, for that matter, just a pragmatist and not a Russophobe, Martin.
Well, I think the Russians are definitely, I'm quite sure their intelligence services will be thinking the first suspect here is the SBU, the Ukrainians. Now, it may be that this 71-year-old who's done this has done this entirely off his own bat. That's a feasible, I'm just saying it's a logical possibility. But I imagine that the authorities in Slovakia will be looking about who he's been talking to, who put him up to it, where did he get the gun and all that stuff.
Interesting that he wasn't killed, that he was arrested, and this seems to be the modus operandi Russians. Over here, by the way, there was an incident, I think it was in the early morning, an attack on a synagogue somewhere. I'm not sure quite, can't remember exactly where that was. But immediately the guy's shot dead, so there's no way of finding out where he came from.
That was in France this morning, yeah.
So there's a different attitude in different parts of the world, as Michael Hudson would draw the line between these different parts of the world. Some are socialist or industrial capitalist areas where the government actually does have a role, and others are financial capitalism where the money completely controls things. They are police, some of them shoot to kill, and some of them shoot to have a trial. Anyway, let's carry on with Medvedev, because he then says, of course it's not surprising. FICO, with whom I have been in contact, he says, since 2008, stands for the part of the European establishment that has kept touch with reality and does not wish for its citizens to turn into grey, radioactive ashes. And surely he's got to be the target. In Europe, there are very few like him, and now they ought to take good care of their security. Yes, the assassin is a fierce renegade from among the intellectuals, a certain topsy-turvy version of Gavrilo Princip.
Yeah, who's that? Gavrilo Princip was the assassin of Archduke Ferdinand in 1914.
Ah, right. So this is back to pre-First World War again. Yes, he wasn't fond of FICO and would write some bleep nonsense about him, some bad poetry. However, his action stands for the quintessential New Europe, moronically Russophobic, feudatory, unbridled, and completely brainless, devoid of any desire to grasp the simplest things, ready to throw its citizens into the furnace of self-serving American politics, the Europe of detestable degenerates with no knowledge of their own history, which is why Macron, Sunak, Scholz and von der Leyen can so far feel safe for their skins. This, I mean, this is quite fiery stuff, and it's actually quite articulate from Medvedev, don't you think?
Well, Medvedev is well known for being very articulate and also much different speaking style from Putin. He's more pugilistic. Putin, in fact, is quite sort of careful in the way he uses language.
I'd like to hear an interview with him on the news, Newsnight, Sky. Let's hear him talking this talk, because this is what we need to hear. Anyway, he says, Macron, Sunak, Scholz and von der Leyen can so far feel safe in their skins. So far, he says. Now it's turned out that, according to the local media, the assassin used to participate in anti-government meetings. He insulted authorities and shouted, glory to Ukraine. I'm not surprised at all. Now the supporters of Banderovsky are trying to murder European leaders. Wait and see what comes next. And as for Robert Fico, I wish him the fastest recovery from this grave injury.
Well, I think that it's quite clear that the guy who fired the shot was firing it at Fico because of his views on the Ukraine. So, you know, it's a bit like we know that Aaron Bushnell, who burned himself to death outside the Israeli embassy, we know what he's doing for, because he was shouting free Palestine as he expired. This guy, his views are well known. He's very much in favour of the Ukraine, very much anti-Russian, and his motive for shooting Fico is clear. It's because Fico is regarded as a traitor because he's not anti-Russian enough. Now, that may be that he's an individual, but I suspect there's also a hand behind it. The Ukrainians have been assassinating people they don't like for quite a long time now. They've got form for this. So, as I said earlier, Zakhachenko, who used to be the Prime Minister of the Donbass Republic, not recognised by the West, but he had been elected, he was killed in an assassination attempt, which was clearly an organised assassination attempt. It wasn't a lone hit. That was carried out by the SBU, no doubt with advice from MI6 and the CIA.
Yeah, I pick up specifically on what Medvedev says there about the fact that we don't teach history properly. And well, that seems, he's saying that's on purpose, because if you knew your history, the people who are trying to repeat it wouldn't be able to.
Well, as Bob Marley famously said, know your history, know your destiny, in the abundance of water, the fool is thirsty. They try to, I mean, Rishi Sunak in his speech earlier was going to, people who want to try and change our history, and it's like, what history? I mean, you don't even know any history. It's like, well, let's discuss the Second World War in the Soviet Union. That's not history. Yes, it is. Of course it's history. I mean, the history of Britain is extremely complicated and rather nasty. I mean, Caroline Elkin's latest book about the British Empire shows that it was a pretty brutal exercise. It wasn't at all a benevolent exercise, and that's just the truth. And
I don't think the Romans were a benevolent exercise.
Well, exactly.
But the thing is that they did impose this order, which I think some parts of the world, they still look to the British as, well, they imposed some order around here.
Well, that's the British like to say that.
I think
we're
like the Roman Empire, aren't we? No, yes. That's not the case, Martin. Well, I've spoken to Indians, people I met over in Iran from India were saying, well, yes, we know India is in a real mess, and some people say it was better when the British were here, the justice system was better. It's not just a British thing. So this is, as much as anyone else should be able to see the similarities between the Roman Empire and the British Empire.
The Roman Empire ultimately collapsed because everybody got fed up with it. And that's what happened to the British Empire as well.
The Visigoths or something, actually.
Well, no, it was also internal breakdown. Because the poor had no stake
in
it.
That's absolutely what's happening, isn't it? Well, in the United States and Britain, in the Anglo-Zionist Empire. Is it a controlled collapse, or is it just completely random? Surely it's controlled.
Not, listen, there are two things. All these big forces are at work, and you've also got very well-organised groups who are pushing the envelope. The people who carried out the 9/11 attack are wicked, by any definition, and they're not from a cave in Afghanistan. They're embedded deeply inside the US security structure, and many of them, it looks like it was a partly Israeli operation, and we've got loads of evidence to suggest that. That's not foolishness to say so. The Israelis go around killing people they don't like individually and collectively. The Ukrainians go around killing people they don't like individually and collectively. But guess who gets accused of going around killing people? It's Putin. And, of course, this is projection by the West.
Anyway, Aaron Gupta is, I don't really know who he is. I spotted him on Facebook this week. Never really come across him before. He had some interesting stuff to say about universities and this whole idea of controlling history through them, very Orwellian fashion. So elite universities, he says, are hedge funds attached to real estate empires run by right-wing billionaires with lucrative research arms enmeshed with the military surveillance state and a side hustle in education that makes their vast holdings tax-free.
That is exactly right.
If you think
of universities in the West as run by the government for the common good, that I mean, to some extent that was true at one stage. I mean, I went to Oxford University back in the 70s and I got a free education. But of course they've now become businesses, and as businesses they function like all other businesses.
Tax free, man.
Yes, well, tax-free. That's the point, because it's education. And also, private schools, because it's education, it's tax free.
I'm not sure who it was, but somebody that shared it also said no actual education is taught.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
Grooming. Listen, just grooming to be efficient, obedient workers in the power behind the throne.
Well, that is true, but you've seen both students and faculty across the United States standing up to be counted against this attempt to bully students. I mean, it's absolutely incredible what's going on there. So we got billionaire Bill Ackers with Jerry Seinfeld's wife paying for a mob to come and attack peaceful protesters with fireworks and baseball bats while the police watch on. Then that's touted in the world media as violence at the demonstrations. And then Biden says we're going to close down all these demonstrations because they're violent. But no, the only violence has come from the right wing, and they weren't even students. And look, a lot of them were, they're all sort of bodybuilders and stuff like this, Iranian monarchists. They've identified quite a lot of the 200 people that attacked the protest. The Los Angeles Police Department should just bang them up, but they're not going to, because the whole pressure is to close down these protests. 2,500 students have been arrested now in the United States of America. The people run various companies, so they're never going to be employed, blah, blah, blah. They're really trying to bully these young people, but to their great credit, American young people are standing up for the sort of things that their grandparents did in opposing the Vietnam War.
Well, they can see the older generation screwing up the future for them.
Well, that's right. And, of course, being as they're getting all these debts to go to university and all the rest of it, they know very well that they're not necessarily going to be in the top 1% when it comes down to it.
The other thing is, Rishi Sunak was trumpeting the wonderful IMF. Now, they're an organisation. You say, oh, the IMF forecasts for Britain are great, and they like me. They think I'm fantastic. That is rather concerning too, isn't it? The IMF is not really... I mean, I think the idea is that they try to put themselves across as a bit like the Office of Budget Responsibility. We're just giving you the numbers, and these are dispassionate forecasts, but they're not at all, really, are they? And they're based, of course, in the United States.
Well, I mean, the IMF is regarded in the developing world as simply the bailiffs for the US bank, yeah, US and British banks.
Neo-colonialism.
That's what they are. And, of course, that's why the Russians, the Chinese, the South Africans and others are talking about they've set up their own alternative banking system based in Shanghai with Dilma Rousseff, who's the president of Brazil, at the head of it.
Good luck to them. I say good luck to them. And maybe it will cause our leaders to actually start being a little bit more realistic about their economics. The article, by the way, I'm going to share on our show page is from a website called nakedcapitalism.com. I don't know if you ever...
Yeah, I read that every day.
It's quite good, isn't
it? Eve Smith, yeah. It's not my real name, but But she, it's fairly high level on the economics front, but it covers lots of other things.
Well, it's a great article on there I spotted this week. The IMF's chronicle of a catastrophe foretold. The global elite are suppressing effective demand and forcing austerity on nations for no other reason than to protect the value of their financial assets against inflation. Ordinary folk must suffer so they can stay rich. Well, I didn't hear that in Rishi Rich's speak or Rachel Reeves's.
No. And that's what happens within the mainstream is that most people, frankly, are not very educated about economics, and nobody's trying to educate them either.
It's a dark art.
Well, yes, it's made to sound terribly, terribly complicated. You don't really understand it, so just leave it to us. In actual fact, it's a lot. I used to teach A-level economics. It's actually much more straightforward than people think. And you can understand it if you put your mind to it.
And
but
if
a lot
you
of
read,
a lot of things are not as they appear.
And if you read nakedcapitalism.com, so they're pretty consistent, are they?
Yeah, I mean, Eve Smith is it's her website, but she has all sorts of people contributing, and also the threads are good as well.
Well, let me read what Eve's is saying in this article this week. Major international agencies are trying to put a positive spin on their economic forecasts, even when they're less than rosy. A journalist depicts a gloomy new IMF report as yet more confirmation of warnings about looming economic crises in poor nations, with finance-obsessed tight monetary policies in advanced economies making this bad situation even worse. The IMF is warning of a decade ahead of tepid growth and popular discontent, with the poorest economies worst off. But as with inaction on Gaza, little is being done multilaterally to avert the imminent catastrophe, noting the world economy has lost $3.3 trillion since 2020. International Monetary Fund IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva announced this grim warning before last month's spring meetings of the Bretton Woods institutions. Well, I mean, basically, these are they're grim-faced people because money is no longer serving the populations of the world. It's serving an increasingly small and beleaguered super elite.
Well, that's right. I mean, the IMF and the World Bank are, in theory, public institutions. And, you know, you get a say on the board, depending on how much money you've put in. But the Americans make quite sure that they've got a dominant, you know, that they get, they've dominate both boards. So.
Can I just say something very basic about privatisation of water? Because, you know, over here, what we're seeing is water bills increasing the most in 20 years last year, another more increases this year. There is a choice there, isn't there, between either refinancing these privatised water companies and putting the bills up as part of that deal, or else nationalising them, renationalising them. So, you know, is there any possibility that the Labour Party might consider taking some of these things that Thatcher sold off on the open market to the rest of the world back into public ownership?
Well, they've obviously suggested the low-hanging fruit of the railways.
Just think also, though, about this thing in Brixham, where people have been drinking poison, because the water companies are not...
Yes.
Actually, it's not... Is it cryptosporidium?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the thing is, they shouldn't be really renationalised because they've got massive debts. They should simply be bankrupted, and the people who own those... people who own that debt, they should be bankrupted as well, because that's the whole point of capitalism.
Oh, dear. Well, you know what would happen is the people like the merchant venturers who own big shareholders... Yeah. Well, in all these public utilities, which the Thatcher government sold off and the major government sold off, they would have to lose their shareholdings, which, by the way, because they're under Royal Charter, you're not allowed to know they've got them in
the
first
place. Well, exactly, but the point is, renationalisation, where you pay compensation to the existing owners, I don't think that's appropriate in the case of the water companies, because they've basically wrecked those companies, and there's no reason why they should be paid to go away. They should be allowed, the company should be allowed to collapse, and then the government should take it over for nothing. Yeah.
So what's going on is people who've got shares in these water companies are being paid to have the water industry destroyed.
That's right. And of course, this is the problem with neoliberal economics as a whole. It's like sawing through the branch you're sitting on, because in terms of overall efficiency of your economy and society. But of course, in the interim, it's a great racket, and loads of people are making loads of money, which is what it's all about. And that's what Thatcherism was always all about. You know, most of the industries that were privatised under Thatcher should never have been privatised. And, of course, we went through a whole era where, well, they're private now and we've just got to put up with it. Blah. What will happen when we hit the wall is all of these industries are going to go bust and the government will have to take over and reorganise things. But they'll probably have to do that anyway, because, as we all know, we're going to war with Russia and China. And you can't fight Russia and China with all these private companies putting their fingers in the till. And of course, none of that's going to happen. What's going to happen is Western Europe, in particular, is going to have a massive drop in living standards, while the Russians are forging ahead. Because, you know, there's nothing to stop them now. This guy Belousov, who's just been made the Russian defense minister, is a top economist. And he has gone to China to talk to the Chinese about how the Russians and the Chinese can basically insulate themselves from the crash that's coming in the West. Like the less they have to do with Western institutions, the better off they're going to be. The real vulnerability is China, because they've done lots of business with the West, and that shock will be it'll be very difficult for them to adapt. The Russians much less so, because they've got a very big country with a relatively small population, loads of natural resources. As long as they don't do anything stupid, they're going to be all right. So everybody else is going to be in trouble.
Well, next Monday, Martin, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's term of president ends.
That's right.
And yet he's just going to carry on. So Putin is a dictator, but Zelensky isn't.
That's right. He's going to carry on, because until they've won the war, it wouldn't be reasonable to have an election. Whereas, of course, the Russians, who are in the middle of a special military operation rather than a war, they've had their election.
Didn't we have an election here in Britain during World War II?
No, we didn't.
No?
No, it was at the end. But, of course, it only lasted 4 years. I mean, this stuff in Ukraine has been dragging on since 2014, you know.
5 years. 5 years. Yeah. 39 to 45.
I mean, Zelensky's not going to stand for election, because he wouldn't win. And then the West would have to find, it's not clear what would happen. But he's got no legitimacy, because he's banned 11 political parties. Yeah, 11 political parties in Ukraine have been banned. Medvedchuk, who was the leader of the opposition pro-Russian party in the Ukrainian Rada, he was put in prison at the beginning of the crisis, and he was eventually swapped for Ukrainian soldiers. He was treated as if he was a soldier, even though he was an elected politician. There's another Ukrainian politician whose name escapes me now. He wasn't that famous. He was he fled to Russia when the crisis started, even though he was elected in Ukraine, because he feared for his life, and the Ukrainian SBU tracked him down to Moscow and shot him dead outside his flat. And they even boast about doing these things.
Yeah, President
they
Xi
boast about doing these things to show the long arm of the SBU will find you wherever you are.
President Xi has been welcoming yesterday Vladimir Putin to Russia. Agrees to deepen Russia-China military ties. Well, this is not really surprising. The world does seem to be squaring up into different camps and factions for a bigger battle, economically and maybe militarily.
Yes, I mean, that is exactly what's happening. The question is, will it stay under control, or are we going to be turned to radioactive ashes, as Medvedev said earlier?
Yeah, grey ones, yeah. The Pentagon has issued a fresh warning to China about its relationship with Russia as Putin was visiting Beijing. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping held talks in Beijing. I heard the BBC yesterday referring to them as two dictators. Well, yeah, right. Or autocrats, that's right. And actually, yes, Xi is an autocrat, but Putin is not. In Beijing on Thursday, agreed to deeper military cooperation as China has brushed off US warnings about its relationship with Russia. Well, neither of these people are going to listen to the Americans, are they, in this?
No, well, I mean, Blinken went to China the other day and started telling them, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to stop trading with the Russians. And they just said, showed him the door, basically. This delegation that Putin has taken to Beijing includes not just himself, but all of the top leadership that is now, he's created a whole new cabinet of different people. Some people have been pushed out, other people have been brought forward. And he's, the main thrust of this delegation is an economic delegation.
Right.
So they're going to talk about how do we integrate the Russian and the Chinese
Road,
economies.
Much more trade going on, many more cooperation with
That's right.
Like
I mean, it makes much more
technology.
Sense from the Chinese point of view to sell stuff to the Russians and get the money without a fuss.
The Chinese have got a bit of a problem, haven't they? One of the things is they don't have airliners. They're not so good on aircraft.
That's true.
They're all
the
using
Chinese
Airbuses and Boeings, aren't they?
Yeah, but the Russians have got their own.
They haven't. Aeroflot has got none. They've got a few short. I was looking at this the other day. They've got a few short range, sort of what might be several hundred miles, maybe up to 1,000 mile commuter jet type things. But they don't have anything like the big Airbuses and the Boeings.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm not.
Maybe that's a good thing for the climate.
Well, maybe it is. But I read Marchanov's blog. It's called Reminiscences of the Future. And he is a bit of a technical whiz, and he's a former Russian naval officer. I don't always agree with everything he says, but he's a very, very useful read. And what he's been saying is that the Chinese do not have the level of sophistication in aerospace that the Russians have. And if you think about it, the Russians have got sophistication in aerospace.
Well, they've had Tupolevs, MiGs and all that stuff for God knows how long. Okay, so let's just wind up this section by looking at the war crimes trial in The Hague at the International Court of Justice. Human rights researchers have concluded Israel is committing genocide. That's today on the Libertarian...
ICJ, is this?
Yeah, a Libertarian Institute. A group of researchers at top universities have concluded Israel is committing a genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza. Since October the 7th, Israeli forces have destroyed most of the homes in Gaza, leaving 5% of the population dead or injured. University Network for Human Rights study led by a group of researchers from Boston University, Cornell Law School, the University of Pretoria and Yale Law School have published a report on Wednesday this week that found Israel's action in Gaza violate the Genocide Convention. After reviewing the facts established by independent human rights monitors, journalists and UN agencies, we conclude that Israel's actions in and regarding Gaza since October the 7th, 2023, violate the Genocide Convention. It says specifically Israel has committed genocide acts of killing, causing serious harm to and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about a physical destruction of Palestinians in Gaza, a protected group that forms a substantial part of the Palestinian people. It continues, Israel has killed at least 34,568 Palestinians and injured 77,765 other Palestinians in Gaza. These figures in total comprise more than 5% of Gaza's population, with over 2% of Gaza's children killed or injured. And it goes on and on and on, and it's horrible. It's like watching Al Jazeera. But anyway, at least they are saying it. Now, all I've heard on the news reports today is people saying, oh, the Israelis are denying this, Martin.
Well, that's all they've got left, really, isn't it? Just to deny,
statement
deny,
from the Israelis, but no detail from these professors and these universities.
Well, that's right. I mean, as we know, the Israelis have got massive control over media in the West. They get all this money from the US taxpayer, and then they use it to control US politics. It's a self-reinforcing loop.
Ronnie Balkan earlier was referring to this fanaticism of the racist fanaticism of much of the Israeli population, and that is a terrific interview. If you haven't heard it, the full interview from last week, I'll pop it up again on our show page this week. It did take me several months to get hold of Ronnie, and he's in demand. He does speaking tours around Europe and elsewhere. Quite an amazing guy. Great to finally get hold of him. But anyway, here is what he's referring to, and this is a documentary just out called Israelism. And here's a clip from that, talking about the fanatical racism which is programmed in from the very youngest ages to Israeli people.
The non-Jewish community does not understand our fixation, our obsession with Israel.
Good evening, and welcome to the 2018,
to the 2016,
2019
Tadli Birthright Israel Winter Mega Event.
America.
What's your name? Where are you from, buddy?
I'm Michael, and I'm from Detroit, Michigan.
Everybody knows somebody who was in the army. Israeli soldiers, they're hot, they're awesome, they're strong, they're everything we could all want to be.
My name is Yisrael Hanna from Brooklyn, New York. I came here on Birthright in 2016. I joined the army 4 months after I finished Birthright. This is my flight back to America, and I'm still in the army now. Yeah, army's last night.
Kol hakavod. That's beautiful.
The first time I've been to the United States, I met so many nice people. Jewish Americans will tell me things like, we like you, but we don't like Palestinians. Even though I'm the only Palestinian they know. Of course, around that time, I would take it personally. But then you come to realize that people do not know. They know nothing about Palestinian Palestinians or have no idea about what Palestinians are going through.
Coming into Palestine for the first time, I remember asking people, what do you think? Should I do it? And the response that I always got was, you're going to be killed. Found in the depths of my family's house. I found some of my Hebrew textbooks from elementary school. Yisrael shel Simcha, my Israel. Congratulations to Simon Zimmerman for winning the Israel Jubilee contest. February 1998, I was seven. I had like a pretty traditional Jewish upbringing. I grew up in LA. I went to a Jewish day school, kindergarten through the end of high school. I went to Jewish youth group, Jewish camp. Israel was just treated like a core part of being a Jew. So you did prayers and you did Israel.
Israel is something that I feel so passionately about. Like it's, you know, it's my greatest passion. Everything Israel. I became a Jewish educator after my daughter started Hebrew school. I started teaching second grade. During the years, I did fourth grade also. And just to be able to start them on this wonderful journey. I mean, it gets in your blood. And we teach Israel at the day school very well. We introduce them to the food and to the music and to the culture, in addition to the history and the geography.
Figure out which one is the Israeli flag. Draw a circle around every time you see the symbol of the state of Israel. Draw your own symbol of the state of Israel. We also celebrated holidays, obviously. So Hanukkah, Israeli independence, all of it together.
Can you separate Israel in Judaism? I don't know. I can't. You know, some people I think can. To me, it's the same. You know, you can't separate it. Israel is Judaism and Judaism is Israel. And that is who I am and that is my identity. And I think every single thing that I experienced along my life has melded into that. Like there was never, you know, a divide for me.
So that's a clip from the documentary Israelism. It's really no holds barred, looking at just how, and critically, but looking at just how programmed people are in there, as she finishes off there saying, from the very youngest age.
Well, we know, I mean, it's a very powerful ideological construction, isn't it? And there's a huge amount of money in all of this. You know, it's you know, you can get a whole lifestyle out of getting involved in it, being part of it, identifying with it.
It's a gravy train.
It's a gravy train for some.
Yeah.
And
well, if you jump on it, you're going to be on the gravy train,
that's
man.
Right. Well, obviously, you've got people who go backwards and forwards between, settlements in the West Bank, and they have their holidays back in the US, as we were hearing. I've been in the Israeli army, I'm still in it.
I think, to a certain extent, there's an element of human nature which thinks, well, I don't actually care too much about the ideology of it, but if there's money in it, I'll be part of it.
Well, that's one of the things why the Anasrullah have been attacking Israel's economy, because that's what will drive them out in the end. If you can't make a living in Israel and you can't bring your kids up, and in actual fact, you know, you can't get ahead, then maybe it's time to go somewhere else.
You know, I was when she was talking there about you're going to be killed if you go into the Palestinian areas, I was thinking about my time in Belfast and being told, well, watch out in those Republican areas, they're really dangerous. I didn't find that at all. I found them welcoming, friendly, kind, thoughtful. In fact, there was even an incident where I was taking some photographs with I think it was a Dutch guy I was travelling with, of this army based in West Belfast in one of the Republican areas. And as I was taking a photograph, the door opened and these soldiers came out with their guns towards me. And they were saying, oh, you're going to have to give us your film. You're not allowed to take photographs, blah, blah, blah. And by the time the soldiers had reached us, there was around about 30 kids surrounded us and protecting us from the soldiers. And so they couldn't actually get the camera off me. They couldn't. And so we just kind of wandered off in the opposite direction. But the kids were being supervised by their parents in the local houses in this Republican area. And I just thought, wow, this is just a most, you know, it's almost like a little miracle, these children coming out of nowhere, so that I could keep my photographs of this horrid army base, which was dominating a whole street in West Belfast. And there's millions of, they do a similar thing with in many other parts of the world, where we're told by the Foreign Office travel advice is stay out of this area, it's very dangerous. Well, I went to visit parts of Peru many years ago. I'm thinking it was a bit early 1980s, early 80s, mid 80s. And some of the parts of Peru controlled by the Sendero Luminoso, who were this kind of left-wing terrorist group, were brilliant. They were fantastic areas. So in a way, what they're trying to do is just scare you to go away from the places where you're going to meet the real people. You're stepping outside Babylon, aren't you?
Well, I suppose so, but of course it all just depends where you're going and what's actually going on, and then you can't generalise about this. Some places are genuinely dangerous, not for political reasons necessarily. The barrios and favelas in Latin America are dangerous for outsiders because, you know, if you've got money, then you're a target. You're an obvious target.
Or traveller's checks, as I suppose it used to be in those days. But I never saw any of that. In fact, we were searched by so-called terrorists as we were on a bus journey, and they came on the bus, and they were very, very polite people, very, very decent.
Well, in Nepal.
And they said, they actually apologised for searching the bus. They said that they're just looking for guns and weapons and nothing else. And then when they'd finished searching the bus, they found it. They said, thank you very much. They didn't say it in English, in Spanish. And then took off their hat. The guy took off his hat like this. Thank you very much, everybody. They were obviously, you know, they were controlling the area, but they were not violent criminals. They were decent people. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that people like that. Simon, that guy that does tours around the world, he kind of goes into these areas too. And so it's brilliant that this woman has thought to actually go into a Palestinian area and find out that people are not going to kill you.
Well, that may be so, but of course there is a load of violence going on. Not the settlers in the West Bank are an imposition on the local population, and they carry out violence against locals all the time. So for the locals, it is violent and dangerous. And in Gaza, it's fatal as we speak. That used to be their little area, supposedly, and now they are being massacred in front of the eyes of the world.
Okay, well, we're going to wind up this week by looking at the Wagner. And this is a clip from the interview I did with David Levy. Well, it's not quite. We're going to have another clip after this with Walter Veith talking about was the Catholic Church behind the creation of Islam, which is a fascinating topic. We looked at that last year. Well, you can sniff at this, Martin. You haven't even listened to this, have you?
No. Well, I've just read loads of books about it.
Yeah, well, books don't always tell you the truth, especially ones about economics and history.
About religion.
And history, yeah. Yeah, well, just because you read a big stack of books, it doesn't mean a thing, actually. Because
it means
that many of those.
It doesn't mean they're necessarily
right.
Many of those.
No, thank you. Well, thank you for admitting it. Because this is what we do on this.
Necessarily
this is
right.
What. No, I know. But listen, you know, don't teach your grandmother to suck eggs here. Very little of this, I mean, I never ever say this is the truth. What I say is this is fascinating. Have a look. Make your own mind up about it. And that's exactly what I do. But I wouldn't be letting people hear stuff and putting stuff forward for people to listen to if I didn't think that there was potentially an element of truth in it, would I? Anyway, this one definitely is good. And this is looking into the occult. This is David Livingston, our penultimate item this evening. And what he's doing here is he's looking at the links between it's about Eurovision in a weird way, because Wagner did an opera called Tannhausen, which is actually about a song contest, and it was the favourite opera of two individuals. One was Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement, and the second was Adolf Hitler.
Thank you. Catholic Church has gone through a lot of transformation. And I've had the, this is part of the discussion I've been having recently, and I also treat in Ordo Apcal, is the influence, the infiltration of the Frankists into the Catholic Church. So what I believe has happened is that because you can, it coincides with the growth of what they call Mariology, so the veneration of Mary. And that begins pretty much around the time soon after the, like I said, the infiltration of the Frankists in the Catholic Church. And there was a plot, which is well known, of the Carbonari to eventually install a pope of their own. And so, you know, according to their own words, they believe they, well, actually, yeah, because there was also the attempt to make Cardinal Rampolla, a member of the OTO, into pope as well, which didn't succeed, but they believe they finally succeeded Vatican II. So there's a whole modern trend of the hijacking of the Catholic Church, which I think we have to distinguish from the period that went before. So that's not to say that, you know, there's various, I want to be careful of the words I use, because I would say, you know, some modifications of the core doctrine, the core teachings of Jesus that happened even at the earliest days of Christianity, because it already appropriated elements of dying God worship. But, you know, that's not to say that they had this like occult mission as a whole from the beginning. When you look at the Templars, they were a Luciferian order that effectively ended up being at war with the Catholic Church. But where this point, in fact, let me start with this is where I think is really a curious fact that, so this is where I'm going to show how it sort of stems back to the Crusades, is because a central character in my recent book is Richard Wagner, the German composer. He heavily influenced two people, and one of them is Adolf Hitler, which is well known, and the other one is Theodor Herzl. I'd like to read a comment that he wrote. Okay, so he begins by referring to the, like again, I said he mentions this in the Judenstadt, and he starts by referring to Heinrich Heine. Heinrich Heine was a very famous German poet, also a Frankist. So he begins by saying, Heine tells us that he heard the flapping of an eagle's wings above his head when he wrote certain verses. I too believe that I heard such a fluttering of wings while I wrote that book. I worked on it every day to the point of utter exhaustion. My only recreation was listening to Wagner's music in the evening, particularly to Tannhäuser, an opera which I attended as often as it was produced. Only on the evenings when there was no opera did I have any doubts as to the truth of my ideas. So this is really peculiar, because this is the same opera that heavily influenced Herzl. And it's an opera. So I'm at a loss to try to explain how this opera could possibly have influenced Herzl and the Zionist cause, because, and I'll explain to you what the basis of the opera is. So the opera is referring to or a recreation of a contest, a song contest called the Wartburgkrieg that took place, I guess it would have been the 1300s, in Germany, in Thuringia. It was organized by Hermann I of Thuringia. And in the contest was Wolfram von Eschenbach, who was the author of Percival, the story of the Night Swan. So the Night Swan is basically, it's a grail story of a man who comes in a sort of some kind of a raft, which is pulled by swans. So he arrives miraculously in this place, and he falls in love with this maiden, and he is forced to depart, but he leaves behind a son, and that son is Godfrey of Bouillon, who's the leader of the First Crusade. And the belief that Godfrey was a descendant of this Night Swan was quite widespread. And so effectively, it's understood that this, you know, quote-unquote Night Swan was effectively some kind of spirit being or demon or something of the sort. So that's what they're suggesting. So now I got to come back to another point, is that the there's a great book. I can't remember her full name. Her last name is Abu Lugat. She wrote a book called Before European Hegemony, I think is what the title is. And she shows how the birth of modern European civilization really takes place in the county of Champagne in France after the Crusades, when the Crusaders basically brought the elements of industry that they had discovered in the Middle East and began to develop them in Champagne, and sort of, you know, developed sort of an early capitalism and an evolution of wealth that eventually gave birth to European hegemony. So it's important because this Champagne was ruled over by the House of Champagne, and at the time, Hugh of Champagne, who was one of the founders of the Templars. And so Champagne, the city of Troyes in France, which was in Champagne, probably the center, I guess, of the Champagne region. And there is where resided Rashi. And Rashi is one of the most famous Jewish scholars of medieval times. And he's also recognized as probably being the first person to have expressed Zionist views, because he's the first to have suggested that the Jews were entitled to possess the Holy Land. He just happened to be in contact with Hugh of Champagne and with Stephen Harding, who was a collaborator of Bernard of Clairvaux, the patron saint of the Templars. So why this is important is because the Crusades were a very enigmatic mission. The Muslims at the time controlled a massive area that spanned across North Africa and into Spain. And so instead of fighting the near enemy, you know, by beginning a struggle in Spain, the Crusades chose to cross all the way, you know, practically the other side of the world and to try to seize Jerusalem, which doesn't really make any political or military sense. So I believe that it was entirely it wasn't a political mission. It was a mission of another kind, because I believe what happened is that it was long known that there were treasures buried beneath the site of the temple in Jerusalem that had been put there prior to the Roman conquest, and that the Jews had lost access to them. So somebody like Rashi would probably have been aware of that tradition and would have communicated to people involved in the founding of the Templars, which is what would have likely motivated them to, first of all, carry out the expedition, but then as well the excavations. So it's been proven that the Templars had conducted expeditions beneath the temple. And I believe what they did is they discovered the Sefer HaBahir, which is an ancient text, because according to the accounts, the Bahir showed up in Germany, first of all, as bits of tattered scrolls before it was then transmitted to southern France, where it was eventually compiled and written out. And it's the book that gave birth to the Kabbalah. And so that same Kabbalist tradition is basically what influenced sects like the Cathars, who were a Luciferian cult that was interconnected with the Templars, but also contributed to the legends of the Holy Grail. So even somebody like Wolfram von Eschenbach indirectly admits that the legends that he was communicating were transmitted to him by Spanish Kabbalists. So that brings us back to the story of the Tannhäuser, which is the opera that so impressed Herzl and Hitler. So again, it's about a song contest where Wolfram produced this legend of the Night Swan, commemorating the spirit origins of Godfrey of Bouillon. Hermann the First's daughter-in-law was Elizabeth of Hungary. And she is known to have performed what's called the Miracle of the Roses. And this is now where you find the beginnings of twin traditions that came out of her influence, and one of them is the Order of the Dragon, and the other one is the Wars of the Roses. And the rose, as I've mentioned several times, is mentioned in the first lines of the Zohar, because the most important Kabbalist text for Kabbalistic interpretation is the Song of Solomon, or what's called the Song of Songs. It's a dialogue between the God and his beloved, quote unquote. And she begins by saying that, it begins by explaining, because there's a reference to the Rose of Sharon in the Song of Songs. And so the Zohar explains that the rose is a symbol of the Jewish congregation, along with the lily, which of course are the most well-known heraldic symbols of European aristocracy, and particularly the families involved in the preservation of the occult. So here's where I'll try to make the story short. But basically, Elizabeth of Hungary is the ancestress of the Landgraves of Hesse. The most important one is Philip I, Landgrave of Hesse, who was one of the primary leaders in promoting the mission of Martin Luther, who adopted the rose as his seal. And he translated he made a German translation of the New Testament while at his time at Wartburg Castle, which was the site of the Tannhäuser song contest. Philip I and his network of Saxon aristocrats, who were all involved in promoting the mission of Martin Luther, it was their two generations later, their grandchildren, who were responsible for the creation of the Rosicrucian movement, which again adopted the rose of Martin Luther. So there you have, basically, in short, the story of the emergence of the Rosicrucian movement, which laid the groundwork for the emergence of Freemasonry, and the centrality of the legend of the Night Swan, which for some inexplicable reason was much admired by Theodor Herzl.
And Adolf Hitler. So that's David Livingstone, one of his brilliant, I think, dives into this whole occult world and the alternative versions of history. The Lohengrin, that's the Night Swan. So you may have heard that before, Richard Wagner's wonderful opera we just heard described there. And there's a great article, I mean, you know, how did Richard Wagner become the soundtrack to Nazi fascism? And what on earth is the founder of the Zionist movement doing being into all the same sort of stuff? Of course, this is a kind of mythos that's being created. It's written hundreds of years before that the Nazis then used in order to sort of motivate their population to be fanatically nationalistic on a whole bunch of nonsense. So the connection between those two, Hitler and Herzl, should not be lost on anybody listening to that. So let's wind up tonight by listening to Walter Veith. This is one of the subjects we covered briefly and sort of skimped over it, which you shouldn't really do, and I'll put a link up to the full version of David's interview there about his book Zionism, which is a history of Zionism. Fantastic stuff he's done, rising to the occasion after October the 7th, to dig into the history of it all and piece together the history of how this organization, the Zionist organization, the International, came to take over to such an extent that you've got ladies talking like in the Israelism film documentary we heard earlier, where it's just, oh, this is the same as Judaism, this is me, you know, creating this idea in people's minds to take basically mind control, to take over the faith, a fake version of the faith. But anyway, Walter Veith gets into really, I think, interesting territory here when he looks at the Vatican, who, of course, in the 300s was founded by Constantine, and the idea that the Roman Empire was going to embrace Christianity, of course, was a lie. Constantine wanted to have a kind of fake version that he could control, and rather than try and kill all the Christians, because they were becoming more and more people were converting to Christianity, the more were killed by the Roman Empire, rather in a similar sort of way as the more people are being converted to Hamas, the more the Israelis kill the Palestinians. Anyway, here's Walter Veith talking about the caves and the origins of Alexandria and Rome, but particularly looking at the Catholic Church and the Vatican as being the actual origin of Islam and what the purpose of that might have been.
Now, this ancient religion existed before Islam, and the initiates of this religion, as we saw in Morals and Dogma, were the insiders, like Origen, for example, and the Bishop of Alexandria. These were the initiates who harbored the ancient religion, and they were Christian, so-called, but of course they were not Christian, they just propagated that for the goyim, Catholicism. True Christianity, they fought tooth and nail and tried to eradicate, and they tried to eradicate the Word of God, as we saw, by changing it. Now, Islam arrives on the scene way after that. So the true harborers were in Christianity before they were in Islam, and they were in two places, Alexandria and Rome. Alexandria was eventually taken over by Christianity, and the bastion, the great library, was destroyed, and the final seat of the occult knowledge was in Rome. So Rome is the seat of the ancient occult knowledge before Islam even appeared on the scene. That is the fact. And this ancient occultism had a potent enemy. Who was that enemy? Christianity. Christianity was growing in the place where the disciples had taught it. Christianity was growing in the heartland of the Middle East, Asia Minor, all the way up to India, the Bible says, into the north of Africa. That is where true Christian doctrine prevailed. They kept the Sabbath. Only Alexandria and Rome did not keep the Sabbath. Alexandria soon disappeared as a seat, and then the Sabbath was not kept in Rome. Very interesting history. So the symbol that Catholicism uses is the star and the sickle moon, and this star, by the way, is exactly the same star as is used in Islam. Isn't that interesting? I wonder who gave rise to whom. Obviously, the one who is first can only give rise to the one who comes second, and not the one second give rise to the one who comes first. Isn't that correct? If we think about it. So, in Catholicism, we find the half moon or the sickle moon, where the deity is in them. We find Mary replacing Jesus Christ as the mediatrix of all graces. The mediator, the sole mediator and advocate, is replaced by Mary. So here in this Roman Catholic monastery, Christ puts the crown of thorns onto Mary, and she has the holes in her hands. Mary is always depicted as coming out of a cave. Now, the ancient deities always came out of a cave. Loyola, the Jesuit, received all his information in a cave, and it is interesting that Muhammad received all of his information in a cave. That's paganism. That has nothing to do with Christianity. Now, here we see in Islamic countries, in this particular one over here, we have this strange structure over here, and we have a statue of Mary on top of it. And Mary there appeared, apparently, as this little gazelle. But before the king shot it, it changed into Mary, and she told him to build a monastery. And that she did, or that he did, and there is the monastery high up on a hill. Now, whenever I find a monastery high up on a hill, I'm very interested, because high hills were pagan high places where they sacrificed to pagan deities. It is interesting that all the cathedrals in the world are built on pagan places of worship. Even the Vatican is built on a pagan site of worship. Nothing has changed. So when I came to this particular place in the Middle East, I went to look for the ancient place of worship, and sure enough, on the hill, there it is, the triple arches of the ancient deity of sacrifice in the cave, as per usual. It's interesting that Mary always appears in the cave. In Fatima, she's in the cave. In Lourdes, she's in the cave. The Pope is always visiting the cave and worshipping in the cave. As Osiris represented the sun in Egyptian law, Isis represented the moon, but the truth is that Osiris represented the male active generative powers of nature, while Isis represented the female passive or prolific powers. That's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. So it's actually a form of nature worship. These people would do well in the Bohemian Grove, worshipping the trees.
Well, actually, they worship an owl at the Bohemian Grove, Walter. And if you go back far enough, I remember looking at this into this, some detail at Bohemian Grove, you'll find they were worshipping a gigantic Buddha. Then that was, I think, in the 1920s, that was taken down and replaced, or the 30s, by Bohemian Grove. So the implications of that are pretty crazy, aren't they? That, you know, that the idea here for the Vatican was to create a religion which was not Christianity but controlled by them, but had the same morals from the Ten Commandments and very similar morals to Judaism and Christianity. So it was a kind of hybrid faith that the Vatican had cooked up. Now, the idea of that was to create tensions in the Holy Land that they could then go and sort out in this kind of Hegelian dialectic fashion. And there's also a lot in that presentation by Walter Veith about the secret society, the Assassins, which was created to sort of go alongside the secret society, the Knights Templar. So although the people were swept up in these faiths and trying to defend them in this massive war, the Crusades, and continuing the Islam, perhaps the Vatican was behind the whole thing on both sides. And of course, that's got implications for today, too. Anyway, just before we wind up, I'd just like to read out a poem written by our resident poet, Patrizia Opulenza, with regard to the PTSD camp in Bath we heard earlier on. Afghanistan, of evil sham, fighting warriors. What a scam. Gun runners, industrial war complex. More lives are lost, but what the heck? As long as there's more pounds of flesh, they really couldn't care less. Our lads in boots, not fit for purpose. Equipment old, not of service. Uniforms shabby, conditions bleak. Truly sad of this to speak. Our wounded home with limbs all lost. No help, no home, nor help with costs. Nor true accounts of each man lost. Iraq, a load of vile baloney. Blair warmonger still laughs with cronies. Lying through his yellowed teeth, prey war criminal. Writ large upon his wreath. So many layers, so many lies, millions of dead before our eyes. The costs won't count as big bucks roll in. How do they think they'll dodge these sins? Blood-moneyed lives, all live to tell, ignoring soldiers, all unwell. PTSD, begging sea, on our streets, stripped dignity. No house, nor home, nor dwelling place, or real help. So can join and face the world again with heads held high. Instead, all left alone to die. Well, thanks again for that, Patrizia. And I'd love to dig out the poem that someone else sent me in this week, but the phone's died. In fact, I don't know for how much this has got to do with my activities over the weekend, but it doesn't seem to be holding its charge anymore. I have to go and get a new phone tomorrow. Anyway, thanks for that, Patrizia. And always worth, I think, looking in on these. Antiwar.com has been pretty good in keeping me up to date this week with various events, including this Pico assassination attempt. So anyway, now time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, of course, to Darren Edmondson from the Norton St Philip PTSD camp near Bath. And to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. And you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. my paperbacks. Been sending quite a lot of those out this week after Richie Allen. They are, well, actually mainly The Traitors of Arnhem, which is a new edition of that, a second edition, which has got a few extra bits and bobs in it. That's £15, the paperback, and you can get a download version of it, as well as a free version if you so wish, which has got watermarks in it and not very good quality pictures. That's The Traitors of Arnhem. Available via www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, and over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioquk.com. Do feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, which is the link to get straight to the stream, and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us this show, just let me know and I'll credit you. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You may be going to Bristol Transform this weekend or Levellers Day in Burford in Oxfordshire tomorrow. Do please join the Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 p.m. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Silken ghostly thread. I gaze with troubled vision on an awful poster bed, where Eleanor had risen to kiss the neck below my head and bid me come along with her to the land of the dancing dead. But it's all right, Lady to a son, like living, dying, seeing, being all rolled into one. And all at once I heard some music playing in my bones, the same old song I'd heard for years reminding me of home. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. And beast desire. And when it seemed for certain that the screams could get no higher, I heard a voice above the rest screaming, "You're a liar." But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. All right, Lady Eleanor.
downstairs. Got my hat and my corny brown leather jacket. The streets, grey and clean for a change. Must have been the rain. Thought transference. And this man in digs with me would cut out two or three teeth and I had something for. Winter is here. Unlike yourself. Shut up, service, kick the leaves, learning about time, time of the Wolverines, time of the Wolverines, they sit rotting, the leaves, kick the brown branches, it is here, I get home. I could say the word entrepreneur. And my problem began.
Cloud in your eye.